The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
It's bang on 7:30 this Monday morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. We're here all with you until 9:30, and we're here every morning. And you can get us on OTB Sports Radio. Best place to get that is on the Go Loud app, or indeed on the offtheball.com website. Owen Sheehan is here, the hardest working man in showbiz.
Good morning.
You were
that was a really bad start.
Go again, let's go.
How are you?
Saturday night, you were hanging out with the Bellator crowd.
Yeah, very good. Very, very good night, actually. I kind of wanted to go along and see what's happening at these events that they're kind of selling out the Tree Arena on a consistent basis. It's well worth a visit. It's a very, very enjoyable night.
The Irish won everything the whole way through.
No, not at all.
No?
No, about 8 wins, 7 defeats.
All right.
From 15 fighters. In fairness, there was 2 Irish fighters up against one another in one of the bouts, but of the 15 fighters, I want to say maybe 13 of them were John Kavanagh fighters.
Right.
It was the SBG show in the Three Arena. He basically was cage side for the entire night.
And a full, like, pulsating atmosphere, good show?
For some of it. It was tame at times, I thought, and for the main event, people left, which was disappointing. So you had a full crowd there for a couple of the homegrown heroes, hometown heroes, the likes of Charlie Ward and Kiefer Crosby, 2 Dublin lads, and then Liam McCaw from Belfast, who was the main event. A lot of blue seats visible, which is disappointing, really. Like, first female headliner of a Bellator European card, and people didn't hang around to watch her. So that was the sour note, but she won. She got the job done. It'll be different. People will show up to watch her next time.
You had Will Fleury in last week. How did he get on?
He won, yeah, and we'll play my report a little bit later on. He was passionate as ever in the aftermath. He's like, I actually saw him immediately after he came out of the cage, and it just he was saying himself that it's just like the best feeling in the world, this drug of actually winning and like going in there and getting the job done. So he's come back from 2 defeats, and he's back on the right road.
So he's the same spirit animal as Eddie Jones in the aftermath of the England game yesterday. You were also in studio yesterday for that, which was a humbling experience as England took our manhood. I realise that you're not supposed to talk in those terms anymore, but they took our manhood yesterday.
We are now, as Irish rugby supporters, living the very life of that guy from Stephen King's Misery. We are trapped in a log cabin.
James Gunn.
And what a Paul something with the Memphis character.
Who's Kathy Bates in this?
Paul Sheldon. About Eddie Jones is.
Oof.
We are trapped in a log cabin, and Eddie Jones is chopping us up limb by limb by limb.
Breaking our ankles with a sledgehammer.
Breaking our ankles, and we are caught in this constant time loop. We would be happy if he just ended it all, and it was just the plug was pulled, but we are still here. Nobody knows that we are stuck in this cycle, and we are trapped here forever.
Exactly. That's the worst part about this. There is no rescue in sight for Irish rugby. How can you fix that team? Where is the next generation of players who are going to somehow match that English aggression? Where are they? They don't exist. Where is the out half? Where is the scrum half who is going to significantly improve our halfbacks to the point where we're like, oh, that's okay, don't worry about it. We have this rescue riding over the horizon. Irish rugby is doomed to a new dark age. If England are going to be as well organised and are going to use the physicality and the advantages, the natural advantages they have with their ability to, you know, use their colonial power to cherry pick the best young kids from all around the world. How did they get those gilded marble halls the streets of London are paved with? We're screwed.
We're in glass houses a small bit there.
No, only a little bit.
Only a little bit. It's not colonialism, obviously.
But no, we're offering Hawaiians and South Africans and the chance for a better education and a better life. And the crack, that's what we're selling. A bit of money in the crack. England are like, oh, sorry, we already have your passports. You've got to take this Polish-made blue passport. Is it Chinese or Polish?
Polish.
I can't remember. Yeah. But the issue is England got organised. England have done what Dublin have done. They have industrialised the process, and they now have a coaching ticket that goes bigger and more powerful than other nations. Why don't we just play a bigger, more powerful brand of rugby? Which is exactly how they won the World Cup in 2003. They got all these big beasts who were like clever and a bit gritty and also quite talented. And they've just done exactly the same thing. Like, we can't beat that. Unless there is some miracle coming from somewhere. I can't see it. How do we beat that? This is like the 80s and the 90s combined, except stretching off into the horizon.
How we would have had this thought about how would we beat anybody at certain points last year. So it just makes what happened in Dublin a few weeks ago against Wales all the more unusual that we actually managed to beat a team like Wales. Like
Wales did to us last year at home what England did to us. But Wales aren't that type of team either, really. They don't have as much power.
No, they don't have a two-laggy. And like, I mean, it's imagine if the Vunipolas were
exactly
playing.
Exactly, like missing the Vunipola, they can still do this to us because they just have Manu, and that's all they need is one player to be able to do it. And okay, all the rest of them are pretty good. Tojo played sensationally and was clearly man of the match, I thought, instead of Courtney Laws. No, I don't know who was picking that. But the issue is we were awful, and so it would be interesting to see if we played very well against that, what would happen. But can we just not play well? Are we immediately intimidated by the fact that we're going up against this England team?
Was yesterday the most unrealistic representation of on the scoreboard of an Irish performance ever? 24-12.
When actually it was a 57.
In 15 years, 12. I'll be going back on Wikipedia if it still exists and thinking to yourself, well, you know, that wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
That wasn't so bad.
Yeah, exactly. Except it was horrific. And what the hell were England doing celebrating after 58 minutes? Like, the three subs were made, they were all chatting and, like, you've got a bonus point right there. This competition is still there for you. There's a chance that France somehow cough up something in the last two games. It's probably not going to be against us, right? You'd have to say it's unlikely that that Ireland team is going to go to Paris and win. Now, maybe a different Ireland team can go to Paris and do something different. But where's our raw power and aggression going to come from? You add Caelan Doris to the team, great, right? And he becomes a man over the next couple of years. But do we have five Caelan Dorises?
No.
Do we have another second row to go alongside James Ryan, who's going to be able to go up against Maro Itoje and Courtney Laws? Where's that coming from? And like, Tadhg Furlong didn't look like Tadhg Furlong again. He looked like Tadhg Furlong in the last 18 months.
And Andrew Porter came on to get his first try, so he automatically goes into start against Italy. I'll tell you what, an Italy game has never come along at a more valuable time for Irish rugby, because it gives Andy Farrell his first opportunity to rinse this team of any of the cobwebs. And if they play well, they hold on to that jersey against France. I'm convinced about that. If John Cooney comes in, because it will be an absolutely outrageous decision if John Cooney does not start against Italy at this point. I'm only using him as an example.
Wasn't great when he came on.
Fair enough. But he gets his chance to start. He does get his chance to start the next day against Italy. He plays well, he holds on to that jersey. And that goes for everybody who comes in, I think, because you may as well just let them go against a proper, good quality test outfit in the final game as well if they do the job against Italy.
So Tommy's in my ear going, well, he nailed that kick, and the two out halves were on the pitch at the time. So you can start Cooney and he can take the kicking off Sexton, and then Sexton...
That's not going to happen. They're not going to take the kicking off Sexton.
Well, they have to.
They might take the 10 jersey off Sexton, but if Johnny Sexton is on the pitch, they are confident in his kicking.
Well, on the basis of so far the performance, that doesn't make sense.
Well, it doesn't make sense perhaps to start Johnny Sexton after yesterday.
But who's going to start instead?
Ross Byrne. For Italy, Ross Byrne.
And for France?
If Ross Byrne plays well, possibly you give him the shout against France as well. I think that, if you don't have confidence in Johnny Sexton as a goal kicker, you can't start him.
You can, because you've got Cooney in the team. It's only one aspect of it, but he clearly is not kicking with any looseness or confidence. And the right leg was heavily strapped yesterday, which there's been no conversation about whatever that right leg strapping. Is that the old injury that, oh, he'll have that strapped forever? Is it? Because it looked like a new bit of information that hadn't come to light yet.
Like, it was strapped against Wales as well, wasn't it?
Was it? Properly? The same way?
There was certainly strapping that existed. I can't remember exactly where it was.
This is the injury from pre-Christmas. But the first kick against Wales was also shanked.
Yeah.
But that looked yesterday like a full-blown case of the yips.
Yeah, it was bad. Like, really, really bad. Especially the conversion was more worrying. You can kind of forgive somebody after a rattling start in Twickenham for shanking the first one. Granted, it was a much easier kick, but the conversion, which was like, oh my God, he's done it again.
Pull it a bit further back. Like,
he was saying that he's just hitting the ball in the wrong place at the moment.
Afterwards?
Yeah, he was saying that to Sinead Cassan on Virgin Media. And he's like, I'm just hitting the top of the ball at the moment, rather than... So he's diagnosed it already.
Okay, great. Like, and fix that. In the meantime, we're just going to take that pressure off you. We're going to give Cooney the opportunity to get into games and give him a bit of confidence. And we're going to use our available resources in a way that we've never done before. Mm. Like, remember all those years that we never used the left boot of Rob Kearney to kick the ball down the right touchline from penalties? That was idiotic. Let's not make idiotic decisions again. Let's make a smart decision. And if Cooney's coming into the team, let him take the goal kicks, because that's like one of the things that gets him up and gives him confidence.
He struck that last one so sweet.
It was pretty good, wasn't it? It was like, that guy, he can take those kicks. Good man. The Irish rugby team looked afraid at the anthem, says David Laffin. Never thought I'd see fear in the faces of Irish rugby players. Not sure about that. Ireland under-20s last two seasons have been very good, in fairness. Maybe give those lads games, says Noel Cahill. And Hanoi Tripper says the key players are a tad long in the tooth. Yeah, the performance clock that Jim Gavin likes to talk about is like 12:30. Midnight is supposed to be the time where, you know, you turn back into pumpkins. The point about the under-20s is that they are great, but they're under-20s. Sticking under-20s in against Manitoulagi, maybe not the best, you know, duty of care and all that kind of stuff. Fair enough, you talked about the last two seasons, but they're still neophytes, still not getting in the provincial teams for the big European games. I want to start with golf because, you know, what's the death march from Star Wars? Play that music, because golf supervillain Patrick Reed is back, babies, and he was wearing a cape, and he romped home last night in the WGC Mexico Championship in the PGA Tour. Now, he had a final round of 67 in Mexico City, finishing on 18 under, and he beat fellow American Bryson DeChambeau by a stroke. Rory McIlroy had to settle for fifth after also hitting a 68 on day four to leave him four shots behind Reed. Started out pretty well, McIlroy, but couldn't get it going enough on the back nine. And Patrick Reed proving that he doesn't give a shit what you think about him or what the golf world thinks about him. Like the week when he had been accused, most blatantly accused, of cheating by somebody that went completely viral in the golf world, and he was like, yeah, I love it, bring it on. So we were actually chatting about him in the office and what odds he'd be for the Masters, and it could be a decent price, and that's all gone. People are going to expect him to win. Moving on to Gaelic games, because 225 to 12 points was the full time score in the game between Galway and Tyrone yesterday in Tuam. I don't know why Galway didn't turn Tuam into like Fortress Tuam and decide that that's where everything that Galway football was going to ever do was going to be there. Like it's the, you know, the cornerstone, the foundation text, one of those like the Raiders of the Lost Ark. This is like, this is it. This is where everything, the seat of our power flows from here, and that's where we're going to train. Everything is Tuam. But anyway,
do we think that the name stadium after the word Tuam is a bit generous? Like what constitutes a stadium these days?
Go on.
Like stadium, you think...
Give me a better word.
You think like corporate level, sort of a couple of tiers sort of thing. Good, or kind of a 360 sort of feel to it. It doesn't, the Tuam Stadium, I think, is a bit generous.
Right.
But yes.
Shots fired, but
still
come on.
Still a fortress.
Yeah,
still
exactly. That's the thing. 225 to 12 points, they beat Tyrone. Now, granted, Tyrone were down to 13 men for the last 20 minutes of it. And there was only 3 points in it at that point. But Shane Walsh, Footballer of the Year, shout looking pretty good.
Well, it's, as people in my Twitter mentions last month said, cool the Jets, don't you dare talk about somebody in perspective terms for Footballer of the Year.
We shouldn't have cooled the Jets. We should have hyped that up because he was
unbelievable.
There's clips going around on Twitter of him, like, ball not touching the ground for about 60 yards. It's like, what? And then just lashing it over effortlessly. So they won by 19 points. The big news from that game was that Colin McShane went off injured with what looked like a very serious ankle injury. So who knows how long he's going to be out for. But we're talking months as opposed to weeks. And I guess he's really in a race to be fit now in time for the Ulster Championship. Limerick's perfect start to the year continues as they beat Cork 29 points to 221 at Páirc Uí Chaoimh in the Division 1 Group A of the Alliance National Hurling League. Waterford beat Galway 17 points to 16, where Joe Canning didn't play as he recovers from injury. Tip beat Westmeath 327 to 16 points, and in Division 1 Group B, Kilkenny and Clare played out a 119 to 313 draw. Ireland's hopes of regaining the Triple Crown and Grand Slam were smashed yesterday, 24-12. As Owen says, the best 12-point defeat that anybody's ever seen on the scoreboard, because it could have been 40 points to 7. Liverpool can restore their 22-point lead at the top of the Premier League table tonight with a win against West Ham. The teams meet at Anfield, with the visitors looking for a victory to take them out of the relegation zone. Man United are fifth this morning after a 3-0 win over struggling Watford at Old Trafford yesterday. Wolves beat bottom side Norwich 3-0 as well, and Arsenal overcame Everton 3-2. In a good game in North London. I'm going to talk about all of that a little bit later on as well. And that is your sport for now. Here's what's coming up on the show this morning between now and 9:30. We have Alan Quinlan, who is outside and ready to go and ready to speak some truth to power when it comes to what needs to happen with Irish rugby. Andy Lee going to join us from the airport on his way home from Vegas after helping mastermind one of the biggest and best performances that you're ever going to see in the heavyweight division. Tyson Fury was outstanding against Deontay Wilder on Sunday morning, essentially our time. Anthony Moyle is going to join us in studio to talk to us about the Gaelic football at the weekend. Sports News coming your way with Tom Malone around about 8:50. I look back at the weekend's Premier League, Gary Breen, and a report from Bellator Dublin as filed by our own Owen Sheehan. Let's do the papers. OTB AM. 7:45 this morning, we're going to start with offthewall.com, and our lead story this morning is Tyson Fury coach Andy Lee believes Fury Joshua could happen in the next... What's your report on this, Owen? Because this is your piece.
In the next few months, I asked him, could it happen within the next 12 months? And he says, absolutely, because I think before this fight, the general consensus was that 2021 is when Anthony Joshua would step on up Eddie Hearn making overtures on Saturday night. And Andy's all for it. He's all for unifying the division and setting that bout up. Suggesting as well that it could take place in Las Vegas. He mentions the new Raiders stadium. So
in the immediate aftermath of the fight, Fury said he wants the... So he said he expects Wilder, who has a rematch clause, he's got 30 days to activate that. He says he expects Wilder to activate that because a trilogy, obviously, very special in boxing. When you get the opportunity to do it, you probably should do it. And he was saying, the new Raiders stadium for that. But him and Joshua, I don't know what that happened there.
Fury a bigger star over there right now than Deontay Wilder, though?
I think after a victory like that, you become the biggest star no matter where you fight. Like, it was so dominant, it was so brilliant that American boxing fans aren't going to be like, oh, I want to cheer for the loser. Mm. Like, boxing fans, fight fans, pretty fickle after a performance like that. You're allowed to be fickle. Like, you don't have any loyalty to these people. They're just people you pay money to go and watch beat the crap out of each other. So, yeah, of course. Like, he's the man right now. Some of the other stories for you. Player ratings from Ireland's disappointing game against England at Twickenham. We got full reaction as well. Experienced players stumble as Ireland deflated at Twickenham. That's Kronk, mother effer. How Detroit Jim reignited Tyson Fury. It's an amazing story. And then there's a clip of you've done there as well, Owen. I'm fighting for everybody, Andrade. You can say no to it all. You can say no to drugs. What was that?
That's Kieran Clark. He was the second fighter up of the night at Bellator, so fought at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. Arena largely empty except for a huge swathe of people who've been bussed down from Jada, all in the corner of the arena cheering this guy on. Got a big win fighting out of SBG as well, and had some great stuff to say about what's been going on in Jada, that he's had the ability to say no to drugs and to a way of life that's obviously been in the public eye quite a bit over the last couple of months. It's been a tough time for the town, but they were in full voice and a good moment for the town at least on Saturday afternoon. Back page of the Irish Independent today is London Mauling. Every single Irish player, including the captain, should be filled with trepidation ahead of Andy Farrell's next squad announcement. That's Tony Ward on the inside this morning. And frustration for Cody and Katz as Clare come back to earn draw. I told you so, says Tyson Fury, who's on top of the world after his superb Wilder triumph. And Aubameyang brings back Gunners' smiles. He scored 2 goals yesterday against Everton.
Yeah, played well. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. The Irish Times. Ireland left trailing in England's wake after a torrid opening act. Yeah, it was game over after 20 minutes, essentially. And confrontational Jones just can't help rubbing salt in the wound is the headline over the Gavin Comiskey piece there about the post-match quotes from Eddie Jones. Eddie Jones was right. He said that they could have declared if it was a cricket game. They kind of did declare. It's a bit weird that they didn't go for our throats, rip it out and stand over our bloody corpse taunting us. They've kind of like let us back into the game to the point where we're like, oh, if Sexton had made those kicks, we would have got a losing bonus point.
They view us now like we view Scotland.
Like, roadkill, essentially.
Yeah. Like, the way we kind of speak after Scotland, the victories where we don't kind of push on after
it's
half-time,
true, yeah. It's like, we got bored of them. Yeah. Like, next. And it's for them, it's Wales. And he says it. It's the biggest game, Eddie Jones says. And then just very briefly, Galway added to list of contenders. So Galway properly now considered a team who might be able to pull it up to Dublin in the big games.
Yeah, you think so. Poor Joyce has started so well there. Irish Examiner leads with the tormentor. Tuilagi rides roughshod over Farrell's Ireland. McShane Blow, Tyrone Talisman injured as Galway surge continues. Eamon Fitzmaurice is writing about how you can call time on players feigning head injuries. Anthony Daly asks, are referees trying to destroy our game or what? And Bruno Boost, new signing Fernandez, fires up United.
The Telegraph, Redemption Day. So England, all about the fact that they're back now from their World Cup hangover, that they're back to the level that they were at in the semi-final when they obviously did to the All Blacks what they did to us yesterday. Jones has last laugh as his players keep alive their Six Nations title hopes. And they also have Gypsy King on top of the world, Tyson Fury with his belts. Fury's win is greatest by a British fighter overseas and inside champion's dressing room before stunning victory. Gareth A. Davis had access all areas on the night and is reporting that it was a great place to be, that they were calm and they were joking, and you know, he was as calm as he looked on the ring entrance, which we'll talk about a little bit later on because it was absolutely amazing.
The Irish Daily Mirror goes with that Eddie Jones quote as well. If it had been cricket, I think we'd have declared mind-blowing, maddening, Martial. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hailing Anthony Martial for his mind-blowing goal yesterday in Manchester United's win. This is an exclusive from Paul O'Hare as well. Champions made Troy loan offer. Dundalk tried to sign striker Troy Parrott on loan before the start of the League of Ireland season. And Mirror Sport can also reveal that Tottenham are open to sending the Ireland international to Oriel Park. But a peculiar UEFA red tape dilemma, as well as a growing injury list at the Premier League club, prompted a rethink. I'm not sure if the injury issues actually did prompt a rethink, because clearly Jose Mourinho doesn't want to use him. But talks between the two clubs were progressing until Spurs decided the 18-year-old wouldn't be going anywhere. To be registered in the Champions League squad, Parrott had to be 2 years within the club, leaving on loan in the January window. It had broken that by a month, so the Dubliner was forced to stay put. So that would have been interesting to see Troy Parrott playing for Dundalk in the League of Ireland. That would have been a real kind of test of his mettle.
Yeah, and what are we at? February. So a good while before, obviously, he ends up playing some European football there. Turbocharged England back to their best, and that's the picture of George Ford with Johnny Sexton already putting his hands in the air, having completely missed the opportunity to just touch it down. In a weird way, Ireland are going to point to the errors in their own goal line. If Stockdale takes the kick the way he should have done, if Sexton takes that the way he does and touches this down. Now, one of them was a penalty advantage, so it wouldn't automatically have been a 22 dropout, but like, those two tries aren't scored, and then suddenly, you know, they've only got 10 points. Like, we just need to be realistic. They absolutely annihilated us.
Yeah, it's a symptom, really, of what happened yesterday, those two moments that led to England tries. The Irish Sun this morning leads with, belt up, we're in for a ride. Fury says, gimme AJ and that'll be it. When shove comes to town, that's EJ Stander. Kind of looking at the mountain there, taking on Mauro Itoje in a tussle. McShane in pain is the headline from Galway against Tyrone yesterday. And Bruno's the past master. He scored his first Manchester United goal yesterday.
There's been a certain uneasiness, I think, for a lot of people about the whole relationship that Mayo have ended up having with Tim O'Leary, which, you know, I think people are going to be waking up this morning going, what exactly is going on here? So, back page of the Star is, O'Leary hits out at Horan. Mayo benefactor Tim O'Leary has publicly called for manager James Horan to be sacked. It's noted football genius and analyst Tim O'Leary. Horan's side had two men sent off as they went down 2-16 to 13 points to Monaghan in Clonus yesterday in a league game in February. O'Leary, a London-based millionaire with Mayo roots, who was at the England-Ireland rugby match yesterday, according to his Twitter feed, and not watching the game. He was at his debenture. He takes his mates to the game. I don't know who they were cheering for, because he's obviously an England football fan, as we also know. Maybe he was cheering for Ireland, was he? Cheering for Ireland in the rugby and England in the football? Is that how it works? I don't know. Whatever, Tim O'Leary obviously...
Coming home either way.
Tim O'Leary obviously has invested a lot of his own money in Mayo, and so obviously that apparently gives him the right to call for James Horan to be sacked. O'Leary and the board have since resolved the dispute. This is the public dispute out with the Mayo County Board. But following yesterday's heavy defeat, O'Leary took to Twitter to post a hard-hitting message. Horan out. We are not very good. Truth hurts, comma, always. Fair play, I say to you, Tim O'Leary, for correctly using grammar and punctuation. It's an unusual thing that happens on Twitter. So unless unless Kieran Cunningham has actually edited the piece and corrected it.
I don't remember seeing the comma there, I think.
In fairness, maybe Kieran is helping him out with the grammar, but 9-point losses are unacceptable. No discussion, he says. I'd say Mayo are delighted that they're taking the money.
I couldn't believe this when I saw this yesterday. I know we're kind of in a rush of time, but he did post this other tweet. I just took a quick photo of it yesterday. Hashtag Horan out, truth hurts, you've already said that. But previously to that, he just tweeted hashtag Horan out, but he deleted that tweet. I did take a picture, I was like, that is very unusual. This is like when Abramovich and Mourinho fell out for the second time, except it's not whatsoever because he doesn't own Mayo GAA. Back page of the Irish Daily Mail is second best. Ireland brought down to earth at Twickenham and Tyrone fears after McShane's horror injury.
Right, that is me done.
The Guardian this morning goes with top of the world. Fury keeps Joshua waiting after demolition job on Wilder. But it's a photo there of George Ford. Eyes on the prize. Jones says team selection justified as England see off Ireland to remain in contention for Six Nations title. And then finally, the Racing Post Cheltenham Festival. Countdown starts here, only 15 days to go. And on the back page, another red letter day. Champions elect look set for a stroll. They're up against West Ham. Their first game since the Atletico game. Is it a situation where West Ham are going to concede 7 goals tonight? Where they're going to be back with a bang Liverpool tonight? It'll be interesting.
It will be interesting to see if they can just rouse themselves or if there's just a little bit of a mid-season that the magic got interrupted. Finally for now, the FT. They've got a story about CVC. Buyout firm CVC tackles rugby with $300 million move for stake in Six Nations. So they've been talking about this for a good while. And CVC Capital Partners is plotting an ambitious reshaping of global rugby as the European buyout firm aims to become the biggest commercial player in one of the world's most popular sports. They're finalising a $300 million deal to acquire 14% of the Six Nations alongside a $120 million stake in the Pro 14 that's going to be sealed by the end of the month. It takes their investment to $600 million since it first targeted rugby 2 years ago. It has a 27% holding in Premiership Rugby, the top tier of English club rugby union. This might be the only way to stop the Blazers and the Elicadoos from not growing the game and keeping themselves the way they have been. So obviously you've got to be very careful when you get into bed with venture capitalists because they're only interested in making money, but perhaps the sport of rugby would actually be better run by somebody who is actually interested in making the best teams play against each other and the best players play a set number of games. And maybe this is where the players' unions start to get a bit of power as well. Right, let's move on. Loads of your comments coming in. We'll get to those about the Ireland rugby team. A row has broken out, as ever, in our YouTube comments. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But in conversation with OTB's Neil Tracy in Twickenham, Andy Dunn explored where it all went wrong for Johnny Sexton in particular.
I really don't think there was an issue in terms of physical fitness. I think it's easily sat up in the stands and being critical, but pressure can do this to anyone, to any player. And I think the captaincy on top arguably did that. He probably felt he'd let everybody down. When he fumbled that ball in our own dead ball area, the reaction seemed to affect him in terms of technical execution more than anything else. He remained talkative with the team. He remained positive in his body language with the team, and he spoke to the referee, but his own technical execution deserted him for the next 10 to 15 minute period, including some important kicks. My other concern was Stockdale's rather lackadaisical or absent-minded attempt in the in-goal area. It's an area where it goes without saying we need intensity, we need attention to detail, and he lacked both of those things in a crucial period for the Irish team in the game. That was a very disappointing mistake for different reasons than Sexton's non-technical, more mental or concentration type mistake. Again, avoidance of simple errors and the physicality up front, that compounded to give England a easy couple of points in that first half. However, we were looking like we creaked physically against them also.
Yeah, we did creak physically against them. Alan Quillen is here. Alan, a pure systems failure from some key players. And yet it seems like even if those key players were playing well, England were going to smash us because they have our number now.
They have, yeah. And I think most teams would have struggled with the intensity that England brought yesterday. I think the worrying thing from the Irish point of view is obviously mistakes will happen and your game plan will break down at times, but Ireland just lacked energy from the word go, and they were on the back foot, soaking up tackles. And England were good, to be fair, very good the way they held on to the ball, and they were really, really aggressive. We just couldn't get the ball back off them. Lineouts we won, we were getting smashed. It was messy coming back to the halfbacks. Their defensive line was really, really quick, and they numbered up really well. So they didn't hover in around the breakdown, they actually numbered out. And just their aggression off the line. So the template was there because they did it in Dublin last year. They did it in the World Cup warm-up game. And
can anybody beat us with that template now? Because we haven't played well against
a team. You're dealing with a team that's very, very powerful, you know. And Etoje is 115 or 16 kilos. He's probably as powerful as a 125-kilo player. Cruz is 125 kilos. And they did untold damage. Underhill is not the biggest player, but unbelievably powerful. He smashed loads of fellas around the fringes. Curry did as well. Laws, big number six. I thought the balance in their back row was poor.
I thought it was risky.
Was I thought just the balance of that back row, given what we saw against France. But France probably coped with England in the physical sense. France are a big side as well, and But England just changed gears yesterday. They got to another level and they looked like they hate the Irish players. They were niggling them all the time and they really unsettled them. And we couldn't cope with that. And that's more angrier than not. That makes me more angry. I don't want to be too pessimistic.
Well, come on, we have to be. When are we ever going to beat this England team again? And how are we going to beat them?
That's a good question. You need to figure out, because people obviously they talk about if you talk too much about physicality and power, you think, well, there's so many more aspects to the game. But the reality is, in rugby, if you lose those collisions, England are 32 impact tackles, dominant impact tackles, so they're knocking Ireland backwards. So it's very hard to reset off those breakdowns. And a lot of the time, Ireland were trying to play, and they were trying to play off slow ball, which is, it's just, the opposition lapped it up. It's brilliant if you're a defender in that situation. Somebody smashes someone backwards. Ball is a bit of a mess coming back. You're just going forward and forward all the time, and we couldn't cope with that. So many aspects of their game were really good, and so many aspects of our game were really bad. Our kicking game was really poor. They actually didn't run that much with the ball, England. They kicked so intelligently. But we're an area a couple of years ago where it was just brilliant for us was the aerial battles. We're losing an awful lot of aerial battles now. And I've said it before, bad kicks can become good kicks with a really aggressive, determined chase. And we don't have that determined chase. We don't have even our kick retreat, our when the opposition kicked us, our enthusiasm to get back around the ball is slow. We're not blocking anyone off. And, you know, to be fair, George Ford, he had it on a plate, really. And when he gets the ball with that much time and space, he can be world class. And just so many aspects of the game, which was really concerning, because they've spoken themselves about, you know, the prep and the feel-good factor and the confidence they would have taken after Wales. But we look shell-shocked. And that's the reality. If people can say it and they like, we were shell-shocked and we were lacking kind of leadership and someone to take ownership, make a big tackle, make a big carry. I really thought maybe we could turn it after about 20 minutes, but I think Bundiaki, or 25 minutes, Bundiaki got a penalty for a turnover. And we were, to be fair, we were soaking up so much pressure. Ireland only missed 10 tackles in the game, which is quite a low tackle count. So to be fair to the players, they were trying to move around the field, but it was just all at one pace. You know, they showed a lot of character, but it has to be more than that. You know, our attacking game was sluggish.
I think this is like a really chastening event for Irish rugby, to the point where this feels like we are so far behind that England team. We knew exactly what the challenge was going to be. Eddie Jones has, from the start of this tournament, laid out that we're going to present a physical challenge for absolutely everybody. They did to us this year exactly what they did to us last year. Only last year they had the Vinopolas in the team. So they were actually a better team last year. This was our opportunity to go up against a team without the Vinopolas. And we had nothing to offer. Nothing from an attacking perspective. And our defence was like chaotic at best.
And we allowed them to niggle us all the time and just get in our faces. We couldn't get our maul going. We couldn't get over the gain line. And it's so difficult to try and play off that. Otherwise, you just drop your 10 back in the pocket and he just kicks the letter off the ball. And maybe we should have done that. We're actually trying to play off slow ball. And there was a period there before half-time when I think Rob Herring knocked on the ball, Bundiaki knocked on the ball. But there was a wall of English players in front of him each time. And you're getting smashed right on the gain line. And we looked out of ideas. And genuinely, it's obviously easier when you're standing back, and even if you watch the game back, to say we should have kicked here and we should have kicked then. But we actually should have kicked the ball a little bit more. We only kicked it 17 times yesterday. And you could probably say 7 or 8 of those kicks were really poor kicks. There was a couple of crossfield kicks from Johnny Sexton when penalties were coming.
Why do we do that, by the way? When England got a penalty advantage, they continue to play.
A lot of teams do kick after that. And it is something that frustrates me when I watch it. Just trying to
Hail Mary,
playing.
Hollywood.
Yeah, unless you suck in loads of the defenders and there's actually a mismatch out in the wing, or even a 2-on-1. We've done that a good few times. And just critical moments. We lost
Aren't
collisions.
You better off rolling up the penalty and keep them going? Because the next time they commit a penalty, you're more likely to get a yellow card.
Most oppositions now do, if there's a penalty given against them, And the penalty advantage, they'll give away another one, particularly in the 22.
Yeah.
And maybe give away two or three because they...
That's the bit where you get in the referee's ear and go, yellow card here, I'll take the yellow card.
And but overall, it was just a very disappointing performance. It was the manner of the defeat. You know,
because you can't see a fix, can you? You can't say, let's just change the halfback partnership and the winger. And
yeah,
all of a sudden
and
it's
very easy to say, well, just make changes and bring John Cooney in and bring Will Addison in, bring Chris Farrell in, whoever. There will be some changes. I think Ronan Kelleher, Caelan Dorris, they're two new players. Made their debuts a few weeks ago. They are going to be involved with this Irish team for a long time. So, on the back of what happened in 2019, it's why this is kind of alarming. You know, if Ireland had a decent enough 19, even if they went out in the quarterfinals, but we had such a bad year, made some progress against Scotland and Wales, and we're after taking a step back. You know, I don't want to be too hard on them because I know what it's like to be a player out there when you just hit a brick wall, but I just think most of the players were in second, third gear yesterday. England were in fourth, fifth. And England, if they were more clinical, could have scored more points. People said to me after the game, well, it was the two kicks and we were unlucky, bounced the ball.
No, that's nonsense.
You could argue that. And I've played in matches, Ger, where you've been under the pump for ages and ages and ages, half a match, and you actually do get the break with you and you actually hang on for dear life. And you do you can turn it around the second half. But I just felt, and most people would have felt yesterday, that even if those couple of bounces of the ball didn't go England's way, that they would have found another way. They were just on top. Now, credit to Ireland, they defended really well. They didn't allow England get loads of line breaks, but we were just soaking up so much pressure. And you just against England, you can't do that.
It's a fairly shattering conclusion to the honeymoon period for Andy Farrell. There was talks about the Monday morning video sessions to having been fairly pleasant over the last few weeks.
Fun, I believe.
Fun. That needs to be different this morning, doesn't it? It needs to be Joe Schmidt style.
Look, to be honest, Andy Farrell, I've huge admiration for him because he came out in the press yesterday and he fronted up pretty much straight away, and he's a very inspirational guy, and he probably needs to change tact a little bit. He's been trying to get their confidence back and get them feeling good about themselves again, and having it a little bit more relaxed, and he needs to really look at this now and change tact a little bit and call a few home truths here with the players. Some players should be dropped, and it's not the worst thing in the world. Just because a player is dropped doesn't mean that they're gone for good. I think some guys need to rebuild themselves, and it isn't the worst thing that could happen to them. But to be fair, Farrell, he did front up, and I admire him for that. And he's always been an honest player, and I think he's a very popular guy, and he's an inspirational guy. But he needs to figure out now, this is a rebuilding process, and that's just the reality. It doesn't mean the people are gone for good, but I think we need to try and freshen things up. And, you know, even if you were to lose matches with younger players coming through, maybe it is the best thing that can happen now. Because
they're not going to do that before November because the draw for the next World Cup is going to be made then.
Yeah, like, I've always said this, Joe, you've got to win international matches. It's important to generate some money, seedings, all that kind of stuff. But I think there is a way to bring in, not to make 10 changes in the team. Scotland made 10 changes, remember, after the team that lost at the World Cup to us in Yokohama. They made 10 changes to that first game. That's a lot of changes in a starting team. We've made a couple of changes.
How much worse would it have been if we'd made 10 changes, though? Yeah. Like, what's the benefit of having a bunch of players who are in the autumn of their career being pummeled by England versus a bunch of younger players who are playing without fear and without inhibition?
There's for and against. You can damage guys even more, I think. I think some of the senior players who've been involved in the team for a number of years now have their performances haven't been good enough, and they've been selected on reputation. But to be fair, everybody played pretty well against Wales, didn't they? So, you know, I think I wouldn't have went into this game and said make wholesale changes just for the sake of it. I think, but now it needs to be looked at. Maybe not. I know there will be changes anyway for Italy. And maybe some players, the experience will still play against France. But I think maybe after the Six Nations, it needs to seriously be looked at. And I'm sure they will. You know, they go to Australia and then they've November internationals, and it is part time that some younger players actually get the opportunity, because
who are we talking about? Who can come into this team? And so Caelan Doris, I think you've got to find a way to get him in the team.
Caelan Doris, I think, and actually our back row, Standard O'Mahony played decent yesterday. I think James Ryan, they're probably only the three forwards who could say that they acquitted themselves over the 80 minutes pretty well.
Tadhg Furlong was disappointing.
He was disappointing. Rob Herring was disappointing. Keane Healy smashed Joe Marler early on, and Underhill, in fairness to him, he went off with the injury.
Yeah.
Josh van der Fleer didn't have the impact that you would hope from your seven. So I think Caelan Doris, Ronan Kelleher, Henderson will obviously come back in. That's going to be three changes. Max Deegan is someone for the future as well. I don't know if how you
get them in the team now or not. I don't know.
I'm not really sure. I think Doris and Deegan could and should possibly be given an opportunity against Italy.
Let's talk 9 and 10, because they didn't have a good game. Sexton, I don't remember a worse game that Sexton's played for Ireland, from the kicking tee and also the handling mistake, but also his kicking from out of hand wasn't good.
Yeah, he looked, he just didn't look right in himself. I think England really did unsettle him. They put massive pressure on him and Conor Murray, but aside from pressure and England being in their faces for our halfbacks, they both made uncharacteristic errors. Poor kicks, poor decision making, and poor execution from two players who've, I think it's 170 caps between them.
So what do you do?
Well, I think Cooney deserves a shot to start against Italy, and I think it's hard coming off the bench to... And it's always easier for players to come off the bench when the game is gone, because things are going to change a little bit. And in fairness, some of the guys that came off the bench looked better than obviously the players who played in the previous 60 minutes. But that's part and parcel of the game being gone. But I think they deserve an opportunity to start the game. So John Cooney does deserve an opportunity. And as I said, Kelleher should start.
Let's talk about Cooney, right?
Doris,
so who does Cooney partner at 10? Do you play Sexton, and in that scenario for you, if Cooney's playing, does he take over the kicking duties now that Sexton is having issues? Owen said in the aftermath of the game, he told Sinead Cassandra he was kicking the ball in the wrong place. If you've diagnosed the issue, when you fix it, you can come back and kick again. But until you've proven you fixed it in competition, which you can do for Leinster, then Cooney has to kick, right?
I don't know, to be honest. It's Johnny Sexton's your captain, so he's made him captain, and does he drop him off the team?
Pick him at 10, but let Cooney kick.
Yeah. Johnny Sexton's kicked a lot of good penalties over the years.
He has, but
Saturday
but
was
everybody,
wrong for
everybody
him.
Has...
Yeah, for sure. I understand where you're coming from. I don't know what the answer to that is, Ger, to be honest. It's probably so... I think you need to analyse it a bit more in the next week or two. But I think you play Ross Bourne. Is Ross Bourne going to start against France?
No, he's not.
So that's where the argument is, you know. And if Joey Carberry was fit, Carberry could start maybe against Italy, and he might have a brilliant performance and actually put Johnny Sexton under pressure to start against France. But that's where the issue is. There's some positions that the players behind are not at the same level. But the argument then is, well, do you say, well, forget about the results now and let's make these players and bring new players through? But I think the captain will start against Italy, I think.
I actually would start him in both games. Like, I think that he's mentally strong enough to recover from his worst game. But I would take the pressure of kicking away from him. And, like... we've heard that conversation that O'Gara was talking about. Sometimes O'Connell would tell him, you're kicking this, and he didn't want to kick it.
Yeah.
Like, the captain makes that decision. All of a sudden, Sexton's in his own head going, am I kicking this as a captain? Am I kicking this as a kicker? I'm not feeling that confident. I'm going to take it anyway. Like, remove all that. Captain
and
tells
let Cooney
kicker, kick it.
Yeah, like, for sure. That's. But it's up to, you know, you can't go up and disrespect the captain and say, I'm...
Maybe it's the coach that
says, you take the kicks, Cooney, because his percentage kicking is incredibly high anyway.
That's the reason to do it.
It doesn't really matter as long as they go over the bar.
It would help him to get into the game as well.
Yeah, for sure.
That's my take.
I'm not sure about that. I'm I just don't see the idea of having Sexton on the pitch without his goal kicking, without getting the bonus of getting Ross Byrne international test minutes. So I think Ross Byrne has to start against Italy. I think that if you're going to make changes and Sexton is not being trusted to kick the ball as a 10.
It's not that he's not being trusted. You've got a more informed kicker on the pitch.
A lot of the time he's bruised and battered. He's getting smashed. He's getting hit late. He's involved in a lot of these collisions. And sometimes he's dusting himself down to go up and take kicks. So maybe there's a time to do that if he is involved in heavy collisions pre-try or pre-penalty.
Murray has been taking kicks at various stages.
He takes a shot at goal, but...
It's not wild to suggest. Like, it really isn't that wild to suggest that we have a goal kicker who's really good, who's going to start this next game. We think Cooney has to start the next game.
Yeah, he does. He needs a chance to start the game. I think he was always going to start. I think Italy was the game that there was going to be changes anyway. And maybe Ross Byrne will start, and that the players and the coaches have their mind made up about that anyway.
England obviously picked 3 second rows and had 2 more on the bench. Do we have 5 second rows who can go up against England at that level? Like, is that where the gap is so pronounced that...
It is. And to have those kind of options and that power, you know, Joe Launchbury is phenomenal in them all. And Eddie Jones said it afterwards. He's on the field. They score from them all. His impact that he makes there. And Charlie Ewell's coming off the bench, another big big man. So he got criticised for having 5 second rows and he's 23. It's horses for courses. That game was always going to be an attritional game. Yesterday, the weather wasn't bad. It was windy. It wasn't raining. But they went for the power game yesterday and they do what they do best. And when England overpower you, it's very, very difficult at times to match that. And we're lacking that power. Henderson was a loss with maybe... I've always said this, that I'd love to see Ian Henderson more physical. When he gets kind of angry and up for it, he can be very effective. Even though, you know, Devin Toner was superb in the lineup. They're different types of players, but we don't have that depth and that strength, and that's an issue. But you're not going to get that every day. You're not going to get that power when you play every time England are...
We're going to get it every time we play England for the next decade.
Or South Africa.
Yeah, so like we need to be able to somehow come up with a game plan and a personnel constellation of players that when we're up against England, this is our team.
I think this it's hard to pick out individuals and say, well, this fella should start, that fella should start. But it should be in the psyche now that this is a rebuilding process. All of the best sporting teams who've had continued success over the years have made changes right at the top. You look at Cody with Kilkenny, 2 or 3 changes every year. We probably have failed to do that. We probably did it in Munster when we kind of got to the top. And I think we have to try and get some young blood in there and expose them and say, right, let's give them a shot at it. And if it doesn't work, then maybe the players who were dropped can rebuild themselves again a little bit. It's not the end of the world. Most of these guys have never really been dropped off teams. Our top experienced players, and they've been wonderful players for Ireland. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But it's not the end of the world if Conor Murray or Johnny Sexton are starting a game. For them, I think they're big enough characters to respond, and they're still very good players, but they're stuck in a rut now where all the scrutiny, and some of it is fair, some of it is unfair on them. Halfbacks in any game of rugby, if your forwards are getting beaten, it's a very, very difficult situation for them. You're shipping the ball out. But I think we panic. We need to find a way when we're under pressure to actually sit back in the pocket and just do the kick tennis. France did it on Saturday against Wales, which was the difference in them winning the game.
Yeah.
They didn't overplay in their own half. And there was kicks up, kicks back, kicks up. And France just kept thumping it back. And then Wales are the ones who actually said, we're sick of this, we're going to try and play. And France then defended. And that's from a Sean Edwards type kick retreat and defensive system.
I've got to let you go, but Stockdale gets dropped as well after that performance?
He's not doing enough. That's just the reality of it. And the hesitation for the try was just schoolboy stuff. I think he just needs to be better. He is an incredibly talented player who just needs to find more aggression or enthusiasm in his kick chases. And, you know, that kind of was summed up with the try. It could happen to anyone. We could all be in that position, but I think he needs to do more.
All right, good stuff, Alan. Thanks very much for that. 19 minutes past 8 this morning here on OTB AM. We're going to cross over to Las Vegas next here from the world champion coach, Andy Lee. OTB
AM. Okay, let's go live to Las Vegas. Andy Lee, how's it going?
Good, Owen. How are you?
Very well. Let's be straight up about this for people who are joining us. It is 8:36 Irish time on a Sunday evening here, so I make this 25 to 1 in the afternoon. Have you slept?
Briefly. briefly, yeah. A couple of hours, but I was woken up by the gang, the Sugar Hill gang. We went down and had breakfast, and Tyson was walking around the ship this morning, and we had actually had a nice cold Bud Light in the sunshine outside the Irish bar in New York, if anybody knows it.
Not a bad way to spend a Sunday morning.
No, and still all buzzing from last night's performance.
I'd imagine so. So what happens in the immediate aftermath? We'll, of course, get into the fight. In the immediate aftermath, what do you get up to? How long do you hang around the arena for? And how does the night unfold?
There's just, you know, yeah, kind of back to the. There's obviously a mad, but it's chaotic, and there's people everywhere. People want to get to Tyson, they want to interview him, and we obviously get back to the dressing room, and we're all celebrating, and we're all photographs. You can imagine what it is, you know, celebrating, photographs, and people coming in and out of the dressing room, all famous faces and celebrities, and it's he has to do a drug test, so we have to do that. Then we had a press conference. Then we all got in the car and went back to which he hadn't stayed in yet. He's kind of villa inside the MGM. Mm. The most amazing hotel room I've ever seen in my life. And we just had a couple of beers there. We ordered some room service. And we just, I don't know, so if anyone follows me on Instagram, you'll see a few videos. but it was a great time. And he had like an after party requirement that he was contracted to do. So we went to this after party and some nightclub on the strip, and then it was back home to bed. But there wasn't much sleep, and then I think I was up to like 6 a.m. this morning calling everybody and getting back to messages from people. So, it's just, you know, it's always an anticlimax after a fight like that. And the simplest thing to do and the best thing to do, I find, is always just to spend time together and enjoy the fight instead of trying to relive it, you know, trying to reach that high again.
Yeah, I guess it's something that can slip away so quickly, or it's like this is a moment that you all know is really, really important, and it's almost like sand through the fingers. You just don't know where the time has gone. But you looked unbelievably happy afterwards, Andy, and I think you've probably seen so much of the social media outpouring of love for you, not just for Tyson Fury last night. So once the fight comes to a stoppage, is it a deep satisfaction? Is it euphoria? What is the emotion that you feel?
All of those things. I was obviously very worried about the fight because we all know Deontay Wilder's power and his record of knocking people out. And obviously the first fight, it was miraculous that Tyson got up in that 12th round. I was also under pressure and felt a lot of responsibility because I was the one who recommended Sugar Hill to Tyson. And also, we have responsibility in him because we've trained him and we've put together this game plan, which most people laughed at when we said he was going to go for a knockout. Most people thought it was crazy, but he executed the strategy and the game plan to a T. And like the punch, the combination that finished Wilder off was something that we just drilled every day in the gym, and that's what's satisfying. That's what's so satisfying, the fact that he pulled it off and he just, you know, followed our instructions. And I was just so happy for him because I know he obviously is the biggest prize in sports, the heavyweight championship of the world, but he's such a gentleman and such a good person. And I was so delighted for him. That's all. That was it.
I think when you mentioned the game plan there, Andy, I'm not sure if people thought you were crazy. I think some people thought you were bluffing when you came on off the ball last week and said, this is the game plan, you know, this is what we are going to do. We were all like, surely he can't just be laying this all on the table. But you basically did, just in kind of very blunt terms. When you go beyond that, when you go beyond the layer of Tyson Fury is going out to knock Deontay Wilder out early in this fight, What was the game plan? How was he going to execute this? Is there a more complicated version to the story you told us last week on Monday Night's Off the Ball?
I pretty much laid it all out on the table for you guys last week, so I was just glad no one from the Wilders camp was listening. It was simple. Press the feet, put him on the back foot. Even if you're not advancing, look imposing. Look like you're posing a threat. It's much less enticing for Wilder to come into distance and try to attack Tyson if he was looking like he was set to punch at all times and that his positioning was good. So it was to press with the feet. Anytime Wilder tried to attack, it was to take a little half step back just to clear the range with a high left hand to nullify the right hand. And as soon as he finished punching, press right back to him. It's that keep the pressure on him, mental pressure as well as physical. Also, when they were in the clinches, tie him up and rough him up and put your weight on him. And jackhammer, we call it, was where he bangs the body and throw that little short uppercut up inside. And, yeah, it was simple stuff. Feint jab, step back, 1-2. And if you look at the finish combination, that's like really jab, step back, 1-2, finished him. And that was basically the game plan. And, yeah, it was risky because you're standing there in front of one of the biggest puncher in boxing history. You're standing in front of them, but you know, was well considered and well planned by Sugar Hill, and came off.
That jab is something that looked so clean, so impressive last night. I'm not sure did it look better than it did in December 2018, or what you think, Andy?
Definitely. Tyson's jab was a flick of a jab. It was like it would occupy his opponents. It would never damage them. Or push them back. It was just like a flick, flick, flick to set up another punch or to occupy his opponent so he could slide off and move around. But now his jab, as I said last week, his jab is a real weapon. And I think that was really telling when Wilder felt that first jab. I actually saw his facial expression change. And, you know, like Tyson took two good right hands at the start of the fight. And even though that's a fault, it kind of worked in his favour because he just took them and kept walking forward. And I think that, in some way, demoralised Wilder. But once he got his feet adjusted and found the distance that he could step back quicker than he had been in the first round, he never got hit with the right hand again.
How does a boxing coach take a jab that is there to occupy its opponent to turn it into something that is a weapon of mass destruction?
You just drill it every day and punch correctly. And as I said last week, he's never really been taught the basics of boxing. He's always gotten through, and like his pad work before would be very flashy and it would look fantastic. It would be 7 or 8 combination punches. But you're never going to do that in a fight. Basic boxing wins fights. People who do the simple things correctly win the fights. And that's what it was. So, yeah. And look, it's only been 8 weeks training with me in Sugar Hill. Imagine when he had 6 months or a year. He's going to improve. He's only going to get better and better.
Yeah, it's a terrifying prospect. I mean, we'll get into the next few months in just a moment. But just one last question I had on the game plan aspect of things. You credit Sugar Hill for a lot of his game plan there. Was it a discussion between yourself and Sugar Hill, or is it all on him? Or how does that work in terms of who's actually implementing this?
It's always a discussion. But no, for the most part of Sugar Hill, I just kind of put in my 2 cents here there, implementing, especially with the step back and high left hand. So I know that's effective for a big puncher. But Sugar, no, you have to give the credit to Sugar Hill. And I, like, you know, in November last year, Tyson rang me and looking for a new trainer, looking for someone with experience and who could improve him. We spoke to all the coaches in the world, people who would have worked, and people we both know. But the only one guy I recommended was Sugar Hill, and I knew that he would improve Tyson. I knew know how he trains. And I'm just so great. I'm so relieved that it's worked out, because my neck was on the line if it didn't.
I'm not sure about that, but certainly it's paid dividends anyway in the end. We've got a good insight into it last night about who was saying what, and I guess the activity in your corner last night. But could you just shed further light on that? Was there a plan in terms of who was going to be saying what, how concise the message was going to be in terms of the voices going in to Tyson's ear between rounds?
Yeah, it was always Sugar Hill, who's a lead coach, and they would have worked together more than I did. So So it was his plan. It was them who worked together. And so he was the main voice. There were times when my instructions license, they weren't technical. They weren't strategic. They were more, how can I say, I basically was telling him to compose himself towards like round six, from round 4 or 5 onwards. It was just basically, control yourself now. He's ready to go. He's falling apart. But pick your shots. Don't get into more, like, you know, just, it was more about the mind, what the mindset he should be taking into the rounds, or what he should be, how he should be, you know, feeling and what he should be looking for. Nothing really technical or strategic, you know? And, it was good. He really did, like it's one thing having a game plan. It's one thing, you know, teaching a fighter in the gym, but to go out there and do it in the fight against the biggest puncher in boxing history, it takes somebody like Tyson Fury.
It must take a fairly calm mind from his corner, though, to be able to actually communicate the instruction, calm down, relax, and you're delivering an instruction by the sounds of things in the space of 5 to 10 seconds. 10 seconds, absolutely max here. So are you thinking during the round, this is exactly what I'm going to say in this very finite amount of time to Tyson Fury? Are you saying to yourself, I need to remain calm here to ensure that he doesn't sense any panic off me? Not that there was any sense to panic at all last night, but I'm just very intrigued in how you managed to keep such a composed head even in the corner, because I'm sure things get pretty hot and heavy when you're so invested in a fighter like that.
Yeah, listen, when you come back to the corner in a fight, that's your rest. That's your oasis. That should be an oasis of calm, because the fight is the fight. When you come back to the corner, you don't need another fight. You don't need to be showered at. You don't need to be slapped, or you don't need to be harassed. You just need to clear, calm instruction. And it has to be precise and it has to be relevant. And the fighter has to believe in it. It has to make sense to him as well. And I think being a fighter myself, that helps a lot, because you know you can read an opponent, you can see what's in his mind, what's in his eyes, and you can read your own fighter and know, you know, is it time to go, is it time to push it, or is it time to hold off and say just carry on and be careful, or is it time to now put a foot in the gas? So the corner should always be calm. But we had a great team, you know. We had Stitch Duran doing the cuts and Sugar Hill leading the corner, and my job was simply to hold the bucket and put the ice pack on his neck.
I think it was a bit more than that, Andy, but I like your modesty on a morning like this. Tell me, when did you know that this was going extremely well? I'm sure you knew fairly early, but it seemed to me, was it after he knocked him to the canvas for the first time at the end of round 3 or maybe, that Tyson just throws his arms into the air triumphantly as if he just won the fight, but not in a sort of bravado way. It was almost like a reaction from him. It was like just something that he couldn't even control. It was like, oh my God, this has actually happened. I've actually executed my game plan perfectly.
Yeah.
The hands go into the air, as I say, not to say to the crowd, yeah, I've done this, and to try and wind him up or anything. It was just a sudden realisation that, oh my God, this is going to be over very, very soon.
Yeah, but he was still always dangerous while, like, you could never count out. That's why it was, like, in the corner, just stressing. He switched on to be alert, because there's a danger of it becomes not too easy, but too comfortable. And then he'll relax, and then something will happen. You know, he might get hit with a punch. So it was always like my instruction from like round 3 onwards to maybe round 5 was stay alert, stay switched on. He's still dangerous. He's still there. And then from round 5 onwards would be to stay calm, stay composed, win yourself, and pick your shots. Keep pressing like you do, pick your shots and put the punch together because he's ready to go. But it was just like an unbelievable performance by Tyson. He's a special, special person. You know, he is really is. He's got an incredible story. And if you were to make a Hollywood movie of it, you'd say it was too far fetched.
So you were saying there that if it was a Hollywood movie, it'd be too far fetched to be believed. But it is reality. In terms of your own emotion now, taking this on to the next step, there are so many different possibilities that Tyson Fury can do with his own career. How excited are you for what's next in this coaching path that you're on, specifically with this heavyweight journey you're on with Tyson Fury?
Yeah, it's like it's come out of the blue, and I still haven't really committed myself to being a boxing coach. You know, I've only been doing it for the last 6 months, but it's been a steep rise. But look, I think he's very happy with myself and Sugar Hill, and I think he'll be asking us to help him again for his next fight, wherever that may be, Wilder has a rematch, the right to a rematch, as the loser of this fight had the right to a rematch. So if he wants to have that rematch, I'm not sure, but we'll see. He might do. I think he might. So that will be our next fight. But I can't see it going any differently, you know? I can't see it going any different. I think if I was Wilder, I would say have some more of a fight somebody else, maybe get a different coach, or bring somebody else into his camp. Not change coaches, but bring somebody else in who can refine him a little bit, and then go for Tyson. Maybe give it a year, get the rematch in a year. But yeah, look, it's an amazing experience for me to be part of this, and a huge honor to be asked. To think that, you know, you have something to offer the heavyweight champion. So, I'm just going to get home now. I'm at the airport here in Las Vegas, get home to Dublin tomorrow, and then sit down, have a rest, and get back to the family. That's all I'm thinking about.
Have you spoke to your wife and daughter yet?
I have, yeah. Been on the phone constantly, and I've got a lot of making up to do with the dad duties when I get back. So that's what my next couple of weeks are: the school run and the settling.
I'd imagine so. Just another quick question on what happens next for Tyson. I know it's too soon, but immediately in the aftermath last night, Eddie Hearn was congratulating you, Andy, on your role coaching, but also, of course, congratulating Tyson Fury because he really wants to set up this Anthony Joshua fight ASAP. Do you think that's a realistic possibility within the next 12 months?
I think so. I don't see why not. It's a huge fight. And I don't see there being any fear from Tyson, you know, or unwillingness to fight him. But these things are very complicated. There's so much money involved and how it's split and where it goes to that, you know, these fights, that they can be very hard to make. But if there's a willingness from both boxers for a fight to happen, then usually they do. So all the talk and all of this, you know, tweeting, if they really want it, they'll make an offer, and then Tyson will have to consider it. But yeah, like Tyson said, he has three more fights in his contract, and he said he wanted Wilder again after this one, maybe somebody else, and then Joshua. So he's always stuck to his word. So why not? It should happen. These fights should happen. Tyson's the best heavyweight in the world now. It's not the two best heavyweights. Tyson's the best heavyweight. But the next best challenger, Anthony Joshua, should be stepping up to fight him.
It's important as well, Andy, that Tyson's not only the best heavyweight in the world, he's also the most exciting boxer in the world right now, potentially regardless of weight, pound for pound. I know we might get you into your pound for pound most exciting boxer sometime, but in terms of excitement, he is, and I think it comes from the fact that he is a heavyweight boxer and he is able to move the way that he does, and that's obviously a huge draw in the places like the United States, but everywhere around the world, like, people will part with cash to watch Tyson Fury right now. It's as simple as that. He is a product on his own. It doesn't matter who's in the ring against him.
They had 8,000 people at the weigh-in, and they had to turn away more. The place was packed. It was so hard to get tickets for this fight. But they're building a big arena here in Las Vegas now. It's the Las Vegas Raiders, former Oakland Raiders, and that potentially could host a fight like Tyson versus Joshua. But he is, he's gone. He's a global superstar now. You know, you saw his ring walk. That was his idea, to come out with Fury's on fire, your defense is terrified, is it? And then to switch into Patsy Cline crazy and be on a throne wearing a robe and a crown. I thought it was ridiculous. I wasn't into it at all. I was thinking, just get into the ring, get the job done. This is it. There's no need for this. But I was actually looking at it. I was in the ring while he was making the way in. I said, nah, what are you doing now? he's more like, and then to get up and sing a song after, like, he's an all-around man. He's a throwback to the old days.
I didn't actually realise this. So you were the bad cop in his coaching staff?
Yeah. I'm very serious about the job. I don't like any messing around. Like, I just like to get on with the business. I'm there to do a job. That's it.
Can I ask you what happened with the water bottle afterwards?
What was the water bottle?
There's a clip doing the rounds of you handing a bottle to Tyson, and Tyson's like, where did you get that water bottle from? And he points the front row, and he's like, I'm not having that.
We're very careful of what he drinks and where it comes from. So we had all our own water bottles with us. We brought our own, like, sealed water bottles. with us to the fight, to the arena. We didn't need anything from anybody from outside. And what had happened is, security man handed me that bottle of water and he said, "Where's it come from?" I said, "I'm not sure." He said, "I'm not drinking." So I went and got one of my own bottles and gave him a drink. So that's the story of it. Like, throughout this whole training camp, even in the gym, we'd bring our, there was lots of water on hand, but we didn't take anything from anybody. We just used all our own stuff.
You can never be too careful, I guess. You, like, I think anybody, you know as well how dangerous boxing can be in terms of politics and stuff like that. So I guess down to the very minutiae, you can't be too careful, especially after such an amazing moment. The legacy for this, for you personally, is important. But then, like, I mean, you look at what you've learned over the last few weeks. I'd imagine it's been loads, Andy, and what you can bring to the likes of Paddy and to Jason and to who knows who else you're going to be working with over the next few months and years. Like, you must be really excited to almost get back into the gym straight away and actually bestow some of this knowledge back onto to your fighters again, because this is a constant learning process as a coach now.
Yeah, it's been a huge experience for me. And even if I haven't learned anything technically, which I have, just to be in the corner and the fighter's magnitude. Paddy Donovan was here. He's been here for the last week and a half, 2 weeks, training alongside Tyson. He was there ringside at the fight. He's in the dress room. So, as I said, I've bring you here, not for the training, it's for the experience to think that one day you'll be at this level. This will be where you're going to be. So every time you're seeing Tyson do something, put yourself in that position and think how you'll handle it. And that's what it means to him. Jason's improving. We're hoping for him to fight in April. Paddy's fighting March 17th in New York in the Madison Square Garden. And, we'll be back in the gym next week. And we'll be back to doing the same things we did. Like, the same things I do with Tyson, the same things I do with those guys. Same basic boxing. Nothing special.
Well, listen, Andy, go and binge watch some Peppa Pig with your daughter before getting back into the gym. Great to chat to you.
I'm looking forward to seeing Peppa Pig and Frozen 2.
You've got to catch up. I'm sure some plot lines have developed since your stint away. Listen, let me give you your outro. World champion boxer, world champion trainer, Andy Lee. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. That's my new outro. An intro, please.
Cheers, Andy. Take care. Safe flight.
OTB AM. On OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
We've got to start playing crazy every time he comes on. Anthony Moles, good morning to you. How you doing?
Morning, Ger. How you doing?
We'll reflect on that boxing a little bit later. Loads of comments coming in about Andy's performance and Tyson Fury's performance as well. But we want to talk about GAA at the weekend.
Yeah.
Two big takeaways from the Tyrone-Galway game. McShane could be out for as much as 5 months, it's being reported. I think John Fogarty's reporting that this morning, and it looked very bad, so you wouldn't be surprised if it was, unfortunately, an injury as bad as that, which is devastation for Tyrone, devastation for him, given everything that's happened this year. Notwithstanding that, Galway, pretty good.
Oof. Yeah, pretty good. I mean, it's sliding doors kind of stuff for McShane. You know, you feel very sorry for him. I don't know if you saw the incident, but he basically just came out. He won a ball in the second half, but he landed pretty heavily kind of on his left foot. And you can just see straight away, like he grimaces, he rolls over. And actually, if you look at it, the foot is pretty much at kind of like 45 degree angle. So I'd say Joyce actually funnily shakes Mickey Hart's hand after the game and obviously says it to him, you know, and Hart tells him, and you can see Joyce grimacing. So I'd say he's broken his ankle or something like that. It's bad. He was actually having an okay game. Young Kelly for Galway was having a brilliant game against him. You know, for a lad who's only been out of minor a couple of years, he was a minor captain, if you remember. He was really aggressive on him, playing really, really well. And to be tasked with marking the main man is a big fill-up for Galway. Galway are good. Like, I mean, I got a bit of slating last week for saying I think they've issues at six, and I still think they do. Tyrone should have had two goals in the first half. They should have. McShane had one where he blasted it over the bar when all you had to do was take an extra step and bury it. And I think it was Hart who had the next chance towards the end of the first half. They are unbelievable going forward, Galway. Unbelievable. And they all go. 5, 6, 7 go like rockets as soon as they get the ball under their defence. Johnny Heaney goes. So they have men who are no problem. They just go and it's support play. They come at angles. And then actually at the end of moves, you'll find nearly cornerbacks coming on in the end of moves. Like Heaney got a goal, I think I remember last week or a couple of weeks ago. Same kind of thing where he comes at angles, slips the ball, gets the ball off the forwards who are advancing back out towards the play. But where they can get caught And I think where they will need to look at is if there's a quick break and they go in behind them very fast, a lot of them are running back towards their goal.
As in counter-attack?
Yeah, right. Yeah, counter-attack. So if you can, Tyrone did it a couple of times, you know, where they put up their rear guard, they set up their defensive wall, and they kind of entice them in. And that, but now they didn't really have, they didn't have enough going forward. Tyrone looked at, they looked a bit light yesterday, so they didn't have enough to kind of quickly break and get in behind them. But they did it a few times, and if they, and when they went down the middle, they found some joy. And even in the second half, when they were bet out the gate, they still had a couple of goal chances in the second half.
Numbering up is actually involves pushing the goalkeeper up and pushing everybody up a little bit, just to and having your water carrier be on the field going, oh, sorry. I mean, like, yeah, there's the dark arts that you can add into a team without saying that they need to replace the centre back. It's about everybody else filling into that gap, isn't that?
Correct. I'm not saying the six. What you're saying is you're trying to, because you get the half back line moving forward in support so quickly that there is a void. So what happened yesterday was the full-back a lot actually stepped up. So he was actually the last man. Kelly was marking McShane, and he was a kind of a free man in. So anyone who came towards him, he engaged him. But what was happening was he's being pulled out then, and if you have anyone running left and right of him, you can just slip the ball past him. And the rest of the half-back line and midfielders are chasing back at that stage. There's
it's
no one coming to meet you.
Yeah.
It's high risk. It is high risk. And, you know, in Shum yesterday, heavy pitch. Like, it was a heavy pitch.
It's never not a heavy pitch in Shum.
I know, that's true. That is true. In the middle of the summer, it's never. Yeah, it is. And, like, I mean, it's amazing. And you still see the likes of Walsh just gliding around, you know. Like, I mean, it's ridiculous, you know. They're very, very conditioned, Galway. They have massive pace in the team all over the place. Guys who you would have thought were playing okay football the last number of years are playing really good football. Like, Conroy comes in then, they have a strong bench and they have an experienced bench. Like, Flynn comes in, Conroy comes in, Brannigan played well yesterday, and they've more to come back. So, yeah, they're motoring well. Well, all I'm just saying is, I think, you know, if you're James Horan, or if you're Cunningham and you're analysing, or if you're anyone else who thinks you're saying to yourself, okay, this is an area where I think we can get them. So if they're coming, it's kind of like Monaghan a little bit. It's charge of the light brigade. It's abandon. It's get ahead of not only the ball, but you're getting ahead of the kind of blanket. So you're getting to a point where if the man can get out, he can then hit you with a pass, and you're free. You know, you're away out into open green spaces, and you can just go all the way, rather than coming behind and taking the ball and running back into that wall.
So if you are Horan or Cunningham or the Dubs who think you might come up against Galway in meaningful competition in Croker, is it quick kickouts? Is it quick long kickouts to somebody who's waiting as soon as there's a score or there's a...
It can be. It's probably the other end that I'd look at, which is, and you saw it with Dublin Monaghan in the second half, which is a really, really hard press by your forwards on the Monaghan defence. Because if you can turn over, it's kind of like, it's similar to a basketball thing in the sense of, so a lot of teams would try to trap a guy, and we spoke about this last year. So the forwards are trying to trap the defender in an area where they're using the sideline, okay, so that he can't go over the sideline, so he has to come back in. And if you can get him, you can put massive pressure on him. But also the real one is as he throws the hand pass out, it's massive pressure on the second ball. Mm. So it's whoever receives that or try to...
Slows everything down.
Yeah, keep pushing them back. And if they have to go back, fine. Go back to the goalkeeper, go back across. But if this guy gets the ball out, as you have two or three people coming at him, if he manages to get it out and up the field, now you're deficient. You have to be, because yeah, you've pressed so many people up. And that's where they could slightly get, because it is a situation where they've come so forward, the 5, 6, 7 are up, you've maybe 4 up, you've a lot of guys in that forward unit, and they're not necessarily turning and just running back, they're staying up there. So even if you looked at the pitch, now it's hard on TV, but there was one or two shots where you look at it, and they've only one or two defenders. They've everyone pressed up. And even when they got the extra man, they said, well, we're not putting them back in here. We just pressed everyone.
That's pretty exciting, right?
Oh, it's great. It's like, great. It is. It is fantastic. And it's Pádraig Joyce, you know. Like, I mean, he's a forward-thinking type of individual. He's meshing, obviously, what Walsh did, which was get the defence sound. Like, maybe he's thinking to himself, right, for the league, we can go full throttle on this, and we really need to develop this aspect of going at different angles, having different scorers, not only relying on Walsh and Comer, okay? Let them do their thing, but let's not over-rely on them. And then he say, well, and now we can go back to, because they should know their defensive duties after the last number of years. That should be natural to them now.
This is like a second system they have now, right, that they can fall back on.
It's a good mix. I'm just saying, you know, I'm trying to say, like, if that was me, or if you were Horan, or if you were anyone else, you're saying, well, that's potentially where we can pick the lock. Now, if he tightens that up, you're going, okay, where are we going to try to pick it now?
Yeah.
Because he's got good defenders. They're fast, they're fit, they're physical. And they've brought that bit of edge to it that Walsh obviously had. They're motoring really, really well. Like, I mean, I think they'll be in the league final. I can't see how they won't be. And more than likely against
Dublin. They still have to play a Dublin regulation football, obviously, so
yeah,
that's obviously one thing, that it's almost like a 4-pointer at the top of the table if somebody else can slide on in to get to the league final. It's interesting that you make the comparison with Monaghan there, actually, and you've kind of already touched on the point I was going to get to here, which is Monaghan's issue being over-reliance on one forward, and perhaps there could be a view out there that Galway might become reliant on two forwards and Comer and Walsh, but I think that's actually just a profile thing. I genuinely think with the likes of Robert Finnerty and Finian O'Lee in particular over the last season or two, obviously Finnerty's only coming in this year really, that they do actually have a selection of forwards. And if you took those forwards, put them into that Monaghan team in 2017, in 2018, they would have made the All-Ireland final and given Dublin a good run.
Absolutely. You look again through the Monaghan setup, but just to go back and go away quickly, what amazed me yesterday even about Walsh is that he is now attracting so many players to him. You know, he's freeing up. So Comer yesterday was the recipient of passes from Walsh where he only had to beat his man. That's all he had to do. And when you're facing him, who's so physically strong, he is like a bull, he's so physically strong, he has a turn of pace about him, he's great balance left and right. So you think to yourself, okay, Walsh has got in behind, let's try to double up or even triple up. Next thing, he gets a pass out to Comer, and Comer has to beat only one man. So he's freeing him up, he's allowing other guys just to be able to have one-on-one situations. When you flip that on to Monaghan, I still don't think they have enough yet forward. Like McCarthy, I think, was decent yesterday for them. He plays 11. He got taken off against Dublin. He played pretty well yesterday. He took his goal really, really well against Mayo. I don't know if you saw it, but he slipped inside. He looked like he was going to be fouled. He spun out of a tackle, showed great upper body strength, and finished it really well. Actually, there was a man inside him who he could have slipped it to, but he finished it really well. He took ownership out of 11. It's a tricky thing, and he is taking a bit of pressure off McManus. But McManus hasn't been setting the world alight, and maybe that's happy enough. McEnany will be happy enough with that. You know, you'd rather him not be setting the world alight and let other lads set the world alight for you. And Monaghan they still have a great half-back line and full-back line who are able to come forward. And again, that's what they're doing. I think to be fair to the coaches of the Monaghan guys, and Banty's probably the first to say, listen, I gather these coaches together, and he puts his bit of magic dust at the top, but these guys basically run the sessions and decide how they're going to play. They have most definitely identified we can't be over-reliant on McManus, so therefore we need a back six who are well able to attack and well able to support and well able to take their scores.
Are Mayo in trouble?
I don't think they're in trouble. I thought they were well in that game, you know, until the second goal. I thought they were well in that game. You know, they were coming hard. They were playing quite well. I felt they're getting most of their bigger players back. Some of the other guys were doing, some of the younger guys were doing quite well. I don't think they're massively in trouble. I wouldn't be panicking if I was Horan. I wouldn't be panicking at all yet. I think they're improving week on week. I think the win against Meath was a steal, you know, and it's something that'll probably keep them where they are. If they had lost that game, you know, lost yesterday, yes, certainly pressure would have been, I think, coming on. But I don't think he'll panic. I don't think he'll panic. I think he's got, I'm not sure who they have left to play. They have Galway, definitely.
And they've carried
and they've
this
Tyrone. Way. Yeah, yeah.
Not the easiest fixture list.
No. It could come down to the Tyrone game, last game.
Can we come back to this in a minute? Because I did want to get your take on the impact that McShane's absence is going to have. If you know, best case scenario, it's a couple of months. Worst case scenario, he probably misses the vast majority of the season.
Yeah.
We talked when he was potentially heading to Australia about the damage that would have from Tyrone's perspective. It took them from not being considered contenders back into being contenders just by his arrival, because he's a Jenga piece that everybody else thrives on. This is a disaster for their season, really.
Disaster. Absolute disaster. You know, I watched him yesterday closely, and Galway did what a lot of teams are doing now, is they just put anyone who was close, as soon as they lost the ball, anyone who was close to Petey Hart, just grabbed Petey Hart. Just grabbed them. And it was, alas, you know, everyone's going on about John Small and Michael Murphy. But, you know, so if I got close to him, whether I was a corner forward or corner back, I just got him and I stopped him, which you can do. You know, I can hit you in the chest, I can stop you from running. Now, there was a bit of grappling, and you can see it off the camera a couple of times. Actually, when Machine got injured, you can see it. But So they've taken him out of the equation, right? So if I'm Mickey Hart, I'm thinking, how do I get him back into the equation? I certainly can't have him in a situation where he's doing what he's doing, which is trying to play box to box, because fellas are just tagging him. I'd nearly play him corner forward. I'd bring him out of the whole show, and I'd give him something else to think about, because he's that good of a footballer and that influential that you can't have this type of thing happening to him. Petey Hart, yeah. Because they're really struggling after that year. Like, they're really struggling. Like, Matty Donnelly's gone. You know, so Darren McCurry is going well, but he's not a guy I don't think you can build your forward line around. He will chip in with scores. He's playing really well. But other guys have kind of come in and just gone back out. You know, there's no one really, really standing. And McShane was such a pivotal point for them. Like, you could fire them in long, you could fire them in high, you could put them in low to him. He was physical, he was able to dish it off, he was able to win his own ball. And with the advanced mark, there was a lot of riding on him. And I think it's a serious blow to them. I think they're in bother. Kavanagh doesn't look...
Are they gone as contenders without McShane? You can't... Like, I don't even know if they were contenders, but there's no chance of them being contenders, really, if McShane's not playing.
I saw a kind of a level of frustration yesterday with them that I haven't seen in a while, where there was a bit of giving out to each other. There was a bit of, you know, and when that starts to creep, I'd say they know themselves that the pressure is starting to come on. It's not a nice situation when you bring back your talisman, who you think, you know what, don't worry about it, he'll lead the line now for us, and bang, he's gone for 5 months. It's not a good situation.
You probably need to clock 1:16 to win a big championship game against the top counties at the moment without Colin McShane in the side. I can't see them getting that tally.
Correct.
So, we want to talk about this because we've been covering the story of the Mayo County Board in some detail. Owen made his reputation as Ireland's next great investigative journalist when he went and spent the night out risking life and limb.
You pronounced the word destroyed wrong there. Destroyed my reputation.
Outside the county board meeting. The instigator of all of the turmoil was the relationship between Tim O'Leary, this benefactor from England who's been... bankrolling essentially Mayo GAA for ages, and rightfully he was looking for the deal that he had struck to be honoured, and he wanted to make sure that there were receipts for all the money that he'd put through. Eventually the row that he had with the county board settled down, and then yesterday he tweeted, I was checking his Twitter account early on, he was talking about the Ireland-England game and how important it is, and the lads he goes with are all, they all have Irish names, but they're all, I think, certainly they seem to be English, as in they were seem to be born in England. But I obviously saw the result coming through from the game yesterday in the league.
Yeah.
League match. He saw the result coming through and decided to take to Twitter and give his opinion about what was happening with James Horan. So at 5:34 PM, this tweet went up. Hashtag Horan out. So his Twitter handle is at Newport Mayo 1951, obviously. You know, 1951. Mayo, 2 likes. That was deleted pretty quickly from Richmond.
What happened, not sure?
That one got deleted. Hashtag Horan out, 5:34. Then he doubled down at 7:32. Hashtag Horan out, we are not very good. Hashtag truth hurts always. And then somebody gets onto him and says, Tim, comma, with the greatest of respect... That comment is way out of order. This isn't the Premier League where results dictate a share price. Mayo supporters support. While nobody's delighted with today's result, we'll still be there in round 7, willing our team to stay in Division 1. I hope to be there, Richie, backing us to win. I am entitled to my opinion, rightly or wrongly, best wishes. That was that. And I don't know, did he answer any more of the questions? They're all deleted now. Yeah. So maybe he doesn't think... it should be Horan out. Or maybe he does think it's Horan out. And
well, the Bahamas. I don't know. Maybe is, you know, look, it could maybe it was him tweeting. It could have been a couple of his buddies.
Seems like it's him. It's in keeping with his.
Well, my thoughts on this are he's entitled to his opinion as everyone else is, right? So he's entitled to say whether he's a fan or not. But some people would say, well, you know, is he? Because if he's writing checks, does that add extra weight? Yes, it does. So he's entitled to his opinion, but he also has a duty, I would imagine, because he's a guy who is sponsoring the whole setup. So his opinion matters a whole lot than just a fella who has never given a bob to it or probably isn't really that involved with it. He adds weight to it. So although his opinion is okay and he can say whatever he likes, doing stuff like that and putting it out there is just antagonistic, really, you know?
It's toxic to the environment in Mayo GAA when you have somebody who is bankrolling it saying that the manager needs to go. This is a brilliant manager. This is a manager who has taken that Mayo team to within inches of beating the greatest team of all time. And here we have some guy who's at a rugby match yesterday who hasn't seen the game tweeting that he wants that manager to go. Like, this is ridiculous behaviour. I think it's absolutely shocking behaviour. And Mayo are now realising that there's no such thing as a free lunch. This guy's going to sound off whenever he wants.
But we're
all going to be following his Twitter account going, what does Tim O'Leary think about this?
But that's where I think, Jared, the problem comes, right? He can tweet whatever he wants.
Absolutely. Right?
He can tweet whatever he wants. And if, you know, just because I sign a cheque and hand it over, right? I still have an opinion, so I can do that. It's the problem on the far side who then feel, oh, you know, he has said this, so maybe we need to react. Like, you can take the check and you can say thank you very much and you can say this is going in here to do whatever development, but your opinion basically matters the same as, you know, Mr. Smith there who hasn't given us anything. It's basically, in other words, it doesn't really matter. The only opinion that matters is the management team and the committee and da-da-da-da-da. So if they're able to do that, fine. If they're being influenced by something like that, well, then you're in trouble. And it would seem they have been in the past.
Yeah.
So yes, it is toxic, but that's where you need a strong committee to be able to say you don't need to be putting that stuff out there.
They might have to come to an agreement where James Horne isn't allowed any of the fun-sized bananas that he's funding for the inter-county team. It's an interesting one. In fairness, it actually makes you think. We actually do have a fairly good culture of being patient with managers in the GAA. It's very rare that no matter what time of the year it is, there's very rarely a clamour for somebody to leave mid-season. There has been plenty of things said, for example, about Mickey Hart in the last couple of years, and I think there's always a general acceptance that, you know, people see their season out and then there's a decision made.
Yeah.
Actually, the course of action is actually respected.
The Dubs obviously did it to Mickey Whelan back in the day when they were still playing in Parnell Park.
But
I can't remember any.
But that was a classic, the chaos days of Dublin sort of move. This would be a classic chaos era of Mayo where they started to do these sort of things. But obviously, I don't even know why I'm entertaining that this is a real possibility.
Well, nobody can take this seriously, is the thing. You can't take Horne out seriously. It's a ridiculous assertion at this point.
I found it funny when I saw it, to be quite honest. But maybe
it's funny for you as a Kerry fan, right? But if you're a Mayo fan and you're looking at that going, come on. Again, we have to be talking about...
Well, it's being dragged up, yeah. So, like, I mean, the question has to be asked of him whether someone is going to ask it or not is, listen, you know, what are you trying to do here? Like, what exactly is your motivation here? What are you trying to plan? Like, I mean, you can't just, as I say again, you can have an opinion whether you write a cheque or not, but just because you write the cheque doesn't mean that your opinion has any more greater weighting than anyone else. And therefore, the person who receives the cheque, as in the county board, has to be able to say, thank you, you know, we're just dismissing that kind of stuff. Probably, you know, we shouldn't even be talking about it necessarily, right? But at the same time, it is toxic. It is toxic in a camp that's probably low in confidence. All the stuff that happened earlier on in the year is still around it. Everything is still coming in. There's probably still, I wouldn't say the atmosphere and the environment between county board and management team and everything is all rosy. Maybe it is. Maybe it's perfect. But It's not a great situation to be in.
I want to make one last point on this, but you're right, we shouldn't spend too much longer on it. But I think it's important because Mayo decided that they were going to take this money, and money comes with strings attached. We all know that money comes with strings attached in every walk of life, right? Tim O'Leary has a relationship with some of the players. There are photographs out there of Tim and some of the players. Is he somehow representative? Is there some suggestion? I don't know, right? And I'm not saying that he is representing those players or that he's expressing the view of anybody except himself. But in the minds of other people, there will be a perception that he's close to some players. He's got this opinion. What do the players... Like, it just begins to bring up all the types of questions that you have when there is what looks like, from the outside, a county that is not unified. This doesn't happen in Dublin.
There's nothing worse than being undermined as a management team. Right, so Horan is in there, and we know the rumours over the last number of years in Mayo, the last 4, 5, 6 years, the time with Kennelly and etc. So there has been this innuendo going on and everything else about undermining happening, you know, that there's groups of players here who want this guy in, there's groups of players here who want this keeper being played, there's groups of players here who want this style being played. That is all toxic. Then you add in this, and that's just a grenade in on top of it. Because not only is it a grenade that's going, but it's a grenade that has power behind it. It really does. It's not, as I said, some fella on some random social website just posting it up. That is a guy who has put euros and sterling and whatever else into this. And as you say, he's befriending very influential people on the team, being pictured with them, giving them whatever, right? So it's rotting from the middle. And you know, there's been plenty of people who have spoken about this and written about this. That is a culture in Mayo that just has to go before they won't win anything until that culture goes, especially the culture of blame that's going on. And this undermining is massively not helping.
I want to finish with this now.
You're Galway, though. You're licking your lips.
Yeah, exactly. Or Roscommon. Or, yeah. Finishing with Meath, because there was another GAA man tweeting his displeasure last night. Have a look at this. The more I think and stew over the Meath GAA under 20 result, the more annoyed and frustrated I am about it. By the way, that's nothing to do with the players or management of the team. Ah! So if there's a holy trilogy in GAA, which is players is one leg of the clover, and then there's the son, which is obviously the management, and then God the Father, which is the county board. We all know this. There's only one thing missing there.
As told by St. Patrick himself.
He was a good Meath man, kind of.
I knew the great man. I wouldn't have been able to get you to read between the lines on this one. Yeah, So this is I was at this game on Saturday. Meath under 20s played Dublin under 20s, and the result was a very, very convincing win for Dublin. Dublin team were good. You know, that guy Archer was playing, and they have some really, really nice players, but there weren't anything that, you know, kind of really blew me away.
This is a good Meath team as well.
This is a Meath team that's backboned by two teams that have been very, very successful. You know, the two teams that basically one got to, won the Leinster, got to an All-Ireland semi-final. You're talking about 7 and 8 of a mix between two very, very successful teams. But teams that have all the way through, under 14, under 16, would have played this Dublin team and beaten this Dublin team. So you come to a point where, and you can talk about development of players from 18 to 20, whatever you want, but that's a whole different conversation. But you come to a point where they then go into the Lions then and they get absolutely spanked and sent back up the road, okay? And everyone will go, oh, it's Dublin and da-da-da. Like, it's not good enough. So from my opinion, why it's not good enough is you have a situation where Dublin have been training, I think, since the start of November for this, right? This is a competition in the GAA calendar. It's not just some couple of counties deciding, let's rummage together and let's have a few games. This is a competition in the calendar. It's not a blitz. There's a trophy for this. There is, you know, you're going to get, if you win it, you get printed. And by the way, when you look down through all of the successful teams over the last 15 or 20 years at senior All-Ireland level, you can back it up with minors and under 20 or under 21 titles as it was. If you're doing it at underage, it generally seeps through. You can see that now in Galway and everything else and all the teams over the last while. So, if you're Meath and you're sitting there and you're thinking, where's our 10-year, 15, 20-year plan? You have to start it at the 14s and 16s and the 18s and the 20s. Okay, and it is at certain levels. It is. But when you come to a situation where you have probably, you know, some people were talking about a kind of a bit of a golden generation on this team, right? So you're talking about a really good, strong, by the way, there was nothing physical. Like, they were as big, if not bigger, than the Dubs, right? Well able for it, da-da-da. So you go to a situation, you say, well where does this rate in all of the different competitions that Meath are going to be in this year? Where does this rate? Well, I'll tell you where it rated. So Dublin start training in November. I believe Leash started training something similar. I'm not sure about Kildare, but I can definitely find out. But you have a situation where Meath started training pretty much the week before Christmas. Okay, the management team were cobbled together, and this is no disrespect to the management team, but the guys that were there didn't get re-elected, and then there was this kind of malaise or a delay due to a couple of things, and not due to one person. It should have been a group of people who were taking this on. It should have been decided back in September, October, at some kind of an EGM or an AGM or whatever it is, who's going to be our senior team, football, who's the juniors, who's the under-20s, who are the minors, who has had these players all the way through, is there continuity, do we need to add in an extra specialism, whatever it is, right? You put sense around this, and instead is, you know, who are we going to get to manage these guys? When these fellas are proven winners, this is a competition that Meade could go after.
At their most teachable stage of their careers.
Right. Go after this competition, win this competition. And then there's some of them who are involved in the Meade senior team. You know, so Shane Walsh is involved in Meade seniors, Matthew Costell is involved in Meade seniors, Jack O'Connor is involved in the Meade seniors, and they've been training with Meade. Dublin haven't allowed one player train with the senior squad. Not one. They are with the under-20s, and they will train with the under-20s and play with the under-20s until that competition is finished. And then if Desi Farrell wants them, he can bring them up. Now, people will say, oh, but Desi Farrell has a massive pick. I would say, you know what? If I'm managing that team, I'm going to say, I'm going to deal with what I have. These guys are 18, 19, 20. They're maybe not going to be able to win games for me. The rest should be able. And I know Andy's under pressure trying to keep Division 1, etc. But the actual decision should be taken out of his hands.
But the long-term plan is that we have a plan and we stick to it. And the reason that they put them in the under-20 squad is that they're going to get more coaching hours, more contact time, and they're going to have an opportunity to shine in their own environment, unless they're an absolute superstar.
Unless they're an absolute superstar, and they're like, whoa. Yeah, and even then, so these guys go back. They trained last Tuesday night with the seniors, 4 days before their match against Dublin. Right, Shane Walsh got injured at that session. Now, he was massively missed. Like, I know he's only one player, but he's a full forward, he's a pivotal player, he's a strong player. So he gets injured, right? And then you're back in with the squad, whatever, on the Thursday. So you're going in again and you're meeting guys that who used to be pals of yours, you played with them all the way up. But how is the management team meant to you know, influence that? How are they meant to influence any type of game plan? How are they meant to influence any type of kickouts? Like, Dublin's kickouts were just so down. You know, they emptied out the left side. They just popped the ball out. They had everything. They were so far ahead.
Training and a plan helps.
Training a plan. Rather than, we have a bunch of really good, talented fellas and we'll just see what happens. You can't. You might get away with it against some teams, like they did against Wexford. But you come up against Dublin, it doesn't work. So, my point isn't right. My point is, where is the thinking on this? Where is the, as I say, the planning on this? Where is, actually, hold on a second, we have a really good shot at this. So, let's put the importance behind it. And by the way, if you're a player, if we were in that, we would feel it. You would feel it. You'd go, when was the management team picked? They see it on social media. Oh, it's picked a week before December. No one really cares about this. I'm going to play with my college. I'm going to do a bit with the club.
I'll try and make a senior team.
Yeah. I'll make a senior team.
Yeah. Look, I whenever the conversation is had about Dublin versus the rest of Leinster and the rest of Leinster isn't getting enough money, it's stuff like this that makes me think that, and Kildare, like, staring down the barrel of relegation and not even being able to compete in St Maguire this year from Division 2 unless they beat Meade in the, maybe they don't even make the semi-finals of Leinster this year. Like, that's the bit where their houses are not in order. Meath haven't got their house in order, Kildare haven't got their house in order, and sure, the funding is an issue, but when everybody has their house in order and there's still a gap, then you go, the gap is the funding. But until everybody actually does what they're supposed to do and puts a plan in place and has people in charge who are actually have a vision and the ability to rally people behind that vision and explain what that vision is, then, I don't know, you're not in the same ballpark.
No, and like, people will throw and say to me now, oh, you know, there's loads of good stuff. And there is loads of good stuff. Absolutely, no one is saying there isn't. But when you have one of the premium competitions in the calendar season.
Oh, yeah.
As I said, it's not like a blitz. It's not like an under-16 blitz in Cavan, you know, on a wet Tuesday evening in the summer. This is a prime competition. Like, you would think that there's going to be a bit of forward thinking and planning. Who have we got? Oh, we've actually got two teams that have won. These guys are good.
And it's in the calendar every year, so it's not like it was breaking news to them either. Anthony, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Now, after their defeat to England in Twickenham, Keith Earls shared the message Johnny Sexton had for the players as the match ended on the pitch.
Keith Earls, was a disappointing day all round, compounded with the poor start. You obviously only got on into the second half. What was the message inside in the change room?
Yeah, as you said there, it was a poor start. Physically, I think, and tactically, they got into us quite early on, and a couple of 50-50s with scraps got their way, and, you know, they punished us and kept us under a lot of pressure. But look, we knew we didn't fire a shot at half time, and we were only 17-0 down, and look, we said we put that to bed and get out and really go for it. But, you know, you can't give a side like that 17 points and expect to win.
It was almost a case of deja vu in comparison to the game at the Aviva just over 12 months ago with the kicks in behind leading to a spilled ball and a try early on.
Yeah, look, they're, you know, the one or two mistakes out of us, but, you know, they're quite intelligent to put the ball there. Their understanding of the game is phenomenal, and, yeah, their pressure, Graham, just outdone us, really.
and in terms of your overall impact, got on into the second half?
Yeah, no, look, I think, you know, when I came on, I think we kind of knew the game was gone away from us, and we started to play a bit then, and, you know, we created one or two chances, got them down the edge once or twice, and I suppose that's the way we'll have to start games. We can't wait for it to get too late.
Johnny was speaking in the press conference there, talking about how he wanted John Cooney taking the kick at the end because he wanted to have a word with the team in the huddle out on the pitch. Can you tell us what he told you?
Yeah, he just said, look, it was a poor performance from us, and we'll brush ourselves down, and, you know, we've kind of a down week next week, and, you know, the championship is still there. Triple Crown is gone, Grand Slam is gone, but still a massive chance in the next two games to go on and win a championship.
Yeah, Keith Earls fronting up yesterday. I think Keith Earls probably straight back into the team as well. Tom, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Probably going to start with rugby this morning. Ireland's hopes of a Grand Slam, of course, are over, having lost to England in the Six Nations yesterday afternoon. They went down 24-12 in their first defeat in this year's competition. Andy Farrell's side are third in the table and face Italy next. And the coach says they will take some learnings from the experience.
To lose by 12 points here, you know, we'll be realistic and understand the reasons why and take that apart and take the learnings from that. But the reasons we want the learnings and to make sure that type of first half doesn't happen again is to make sure that we're still in with a chance to win the competition. And that's the reality, you know. We dust ourselves down and we don't feel sorry for ourselves for too long, and we get to the reality of stuff.
Meanwhile, we'll move on to boxing, and Andy Lee says an Anthony Joshua fight could well be next on the cards for Tyson Fury. The Limerick man helped coach Fury to WBC heavyweight crown with a seventh round stoppage over Deontay Wilder at the weekend. A trilogy bout, with Wilder is one option up for consideration, but Lee says the Joshua fight could well happen next.
I think so. I don't see why not. It's a huge fight, and I don't see there being any fear from Tyson, you know, unwillingness to fight it. But if there's a willingness from both boxers for a fight to happen, then usually they do. All the talk and all of this, you know, tweeting, if they really want it, they'll make an offer, and then Tyson will have to consider it.
Tonight, Liverpool can move back to 22 points clear at the top of the Premier League table later at Anfield. Jurgen Klopp's side host West Ham at Merseyside at 8 o'clock. Klopp has called on his players to put things right this evening following their first defeat in 15 games in all competitions.
The difference is massive, much more than 3 points. It's really from sunshine to hardest rain, and that's how it should be. If you really want to be successful, and if you could be successful, what we could have been in that game, then it has to feel really bad, and that's how it felt.
Manchester United, meanwhile, are up to fifth following their 3-0 win over Watford yesterday. Wolves saw off Norwich also by 3-0. And Arsenal had a 3-2 win over Everton at the Emirates. In the League of Ireland tonight, Shamrock Rovers will look to build on their 6-0 hammering of Cork on Friday night. They travel to the RSC to face Waterford later. Bowes host Sligo. St Pat's will look to make it 2 wins on the bounce when they host Derry. Shelburne travel to Finn Harps. Well, it won't get any easier for Cork. They are off to Dundalk after that hammering on Friday night. In Gaelic games, Tyrone star Colin McShane could be set for as long as 5 months on the sidelines after dislocating his ankle in yesterday's defeat to Galway. The 2019 All-Star was stretchered off at Tuam Stadium in the heavy 19-point defeat for Mickey Hart's side. The 24-year-old, of course, turned down an offer to play in Australia's AFL recently and committed to Tyrone for 2020. That 225-12 win for Galway over the Northerners has them top of Division 1 of the Allianz National Football League this morning, while Monaghan are third and just a point behind Dublin after seeing off Mayo 216-13 points in Clonus yesterday. Meath, meanwhile, still have to register a win after losing out 119-213 to Kerry in Killarney. Limerick's perfect start to the year continued as they beat Cork by 29 points to 221 at Porky Queeve in Division 1A of the Allianz National Hurling League yesterday. Waterford beat Galway 17 points to 16, with Joe Canning took no part in that as he continues to recover from injury. Tipperary easily saw off Westmeath 327 to 16 points at Semple Stadium. And in Division 1B, Kilkenny and Clare played at a thrilling draw 119 to 313. Penultimate story here. Patrick Reed earned his 8th PGA Tour win at the age of 30 last night by clinching the WGC Mexico Championship. Good guys go far, Jerk. Good guys go far. The 2018 Masters hit a final round 67 in Mexico City to finish on 18 under par, beating fellow American Bryson DeChambeau by a stroke. And world number one Rory McIlroy hit a 68 for his fifth top five in as many starts this season. And finishing, if you want to watch something on TV tonight, obviously at the same time as the Liverpool match, but this is well worth checking out, or not Sky Plus it, on the BBC One, on BBC One, Panorama, Mo Farah and the Salazar scandal. So I think that could make for some interesting reading. It's been quite well seeded throughout the press today.
A little bit from Dan Rowan over the last 24 hours or so that makes it look like he hasn't been telling the truth.
I cannot believe that.
He forgot that he got some injections.
Forgot that he got injections.
Look, eventually.
He can't hear the doorbell. It's not his fault. He can't hear the doorbell.
It's remarkable. Looking forward to that, all right. Unreal tactical performance from Sugar Hill. And Andy says, Jay Mulligan on Twitter proved that boxing is not all about power. Although Tyson Fury does have plenty of power too. Waterboy says, I'm sure Andy will be in demand. Will he possibly move to the States to coach? And so good Tyson beat those Yanks, says Hanoi Tripper. So there are the comments on that. Well, you were equally impressed with his ring entrance. Yeah, good boxing knowledge to remember about the Prince Nazim.
Yeah, the inspo was from Prince Nazim, where I think we shared that video with you, and it was in Newcastle sometime in the 90s. But he was actually carried out. And my favourite part about it is Ian Dark and Glenn McCrory on commentary, and they were thoroughly unimpressed with Nazim Hamid.
People in Newcastle haven't seen something like this before.
He's like, well, he's taking his time. It's like just as much dry ice and like women coming out.
It was a waterfall of dry ice beforehand. So it was very impressive. Very, very impressive. Right, good stuff. Thanks for that, Tom. Now, comparing the tasks of facing Carlo Ancelotti at Everton and Mikel Arteta at Newcastle, Gary Breen here talking about how Everton's boss, Mikel Arteta at Arsenal. Gary Breen expects the Everton boss to have a relatively more straightforward, the Arsenal boss to have a relatively more... I'm going to start this all again. Right? Gary Breen talking about... talking about Carlo Ancelotti and Mikel Arteta and comparing the two tasks. Have a look.
The contrast is massive. Bearing in mind, you've got a manager of the experience of Ancelotti, 15 major trophies in five different countries, up against a rookie boss like Arteta. Having said that, you can notice, you're right, I think, I see what Ancelotti's trying to do. A lot of money misspent at Everton, and we never knew really what they were trying to achieve. There seems to be a clear strategy now, but I still expect a big overhaul of players. The thing that Everton have with the backing of Mashiri is that they have the money to do it. Arsenal don't. So Arteta's got to use all his skill set as a coach, bearing in mind that he's that inexperienced as a boss, and create players within his squad and certainly within the youth levels. And up to this point, we've seen the likes of Saka burst onto the scene under him. That bodes well because he was very impressive. A difficult time in the second half in terms of defensively, but he'll add to that. In terms of his creativity, again, another assist, and that ball in for that goal for Nketiah was fantastic. Nketiah is a young centre forward who came in and out over the last year, had to go out on loan to Leeds, but got two back-to-back starts in the Premier League ahead of someone as experienced as Lacazette. That shows a lot of faith by the manager. So I do believe that both clubs are on the right path.
Yeah, both clubs are on the right path. Nathan, how are you? There you were yesterday in London. You wanted to talk about Gary Breen commenting on Everton?
If anybody hasn't done this, get this on your bucket list before the end of the season. Before Arsenal sort out their defence, you need to listen to Gary Breen on an Arsenal commentary. It is fantastic. Obviously, student of the game when it comes to defence, has a very high standard when it comes to Arsenal and when it comes to defending. Arsenal are existing in a sphere at the moment where they are very bad at defending, and hilarity ensues, especially when Scott Mustafi does anything.
I don't necessarily agree that it's a more straightforward job for Everton.
I would agree with him, just because I think expectations are so much lower at Everton. Mikel Arteta needs to turn Arsenal in the space of 5 years into champions.
Well,
that's never going to happen at Everton. Certainly not until they move to the new ground. Like, if Carlo Ancelotti got them Champions League football, that would be unbelievable.
They're miles away
success.
From that, aren't they?
I don't think they're as far. They're about where Arsenal are. I think yesterday, two very evenly matched teams. The difficulty for Everton might be keeping hold of some of their better players. They need.
Can I just ask though?
Similar areas of the pitch.
Can I just ask though? Has the immediate impact of Arteta not been quite significant in that? The team is vastly better now than it was, that there's a vision, that there's an intelligence behind, that there's a design going on at Arsenal that there wasn't previously. And so previously players who didn't look that good or that committed have begun to express themselves. That the room for growth under Mikel Arteta is way bigger than the room for growth under Carlo Ancelotti.
Well, I think Carlo Ancelotti's had far more of an impact in his 3 months than Mikel Arteta's had in terms of results for Everton. They were in the relegation zone when he took over, and they started yesterday ahead of Arsenal. Arsenal have got better, but it couldn't get much worse. Mikel Arteta definitely has a plan. How could he not have worked with Pep Guardiola? I don't see massive improvements in half a dozen of those players, as Gary touched on. Like Bellerin, unfortunately, if you go through that back four, Bellerin, like the injuries are going to take him a long time to get over. They targeted Mustafi again and again and again yesterday. Just a simple diagonal ball between Bellerin and Mustafi, and Richarlison must have got in half a dozen times. David Luiz, is he going to build his defence around him for the next 4 or 5 years? He's not of the age. Saka looks the real promising one. What he's done is he's given a lot of young players an opportunity. But are they going to be ready next season? Like, you're probably talking 2-3 years down the track.
They'll be Chelsea's level tops.
He needs two new centre-halves. He probably needs a new central midfielder if he doesn't trust Guendouzi or Torreira. Maybe they keep Ceballos. Like, Aubameyang is going to be the interesting one. He's out of contract in 18 months' time. He's going to be 31 in the summer. He's an unbelievable footballer. Every time you watch him, like, he's just a class act on that pitch. 49 goals in 74 games.
It's pretty good.
They paid a huge amount of money for him, but can they keep him? The player, if they do let him go, who they should go after, was on the opposite team yesterday. Richarlison, who could well be the best player outside the top four. Like, just his work rate. Everything about him. Gets the goals. Like, Everton should have got something out of that game. He was just an absolute menace. And
better than Jack Grealish?
Totally different player to Jack Grealish, but yeah, I think has more of an impact. And because he's Brazilian, and because he probably threw his toys out of the pram at Watford a little bit, there's sort of an opinion of him that
he's too hard work.
Like, he's not. He's one of the hardest workers you will see in a team. Like, and they play him on the left wing, the right wing. They finally found something, I think, Everton, where they play himself and Calvert-Lewin up front together, and they're scoring goals every single game. But even when Everton were struggling, like, you'd watch him on the right hand side when they play Richarlison instead of Walcott. I'd say Seamus Coleman much preferred playing with Richarlison because tracks back, does everything.
Just on the point, right, so Miguel Delaney was tweeting yesterday, really like Arteta's setup, Arsenal will be a force next season. I think your point, when you go through it as individuals, right, they're all, you can make the case that these players are not as good as the players who are at other teams. But then, good managers, like Klopp, takes players and vastly improves them over a period of time. So it's going to be very, I just think it's going to be very interesting to see a full pre-season for Arteta and a full pre-season for Ancelotti. And they're not millions of miles away from the amount of money and resources that they're going to have. Not a huge amount, really. Not a huge amount separating their wage bills by the end of next season, I would argue.
No, I'd imagine not everything are going to invest massively again.
Let's see. My money's on Arteta.
It could work out quite nicely for Arsenal if they do miss out in Europe completely next season. I think having that sort of break where you've got week in, week out, where he gets an awful lot of time on the training
pitch. Man City.
And there are 3 or 4 exciting young players, but it just feels like it's such an overhaul throughout that squad.
See, I would have said the same thing about the Liverpool squad in some respects when Klopp came in. And remember that first 6 or 8 weeks when Klopp came in and everybody was injured and it was like, oh, they can't take the hard training sessions. Mm. And then it was like, actually, a lot of those players turned out to be much better. Most of them actually probably gone now. But some of those players turned out to be much better when Klopp got his hands on them.
Yeah, like, that's the power of a brilliant coach, and maybe Mikel Arteta has that. And Arsenal were far better and had a game plan yesterday, which we haven't seen since Arsene Wenger left.
Exactly. Is Ancelotti not actually just a Big Sam with an Italian accent at this point of his career? Is that not? Is that
slightly,
like,
better CV than?
Yeah, okay,
than but Big, like, Sam, slightly better.
Recently, his CV, like, I don't think that he's going to stay there for 5 years and invest in, like,
no, but who does stay down for 5 years? He doesn't need to.
Well, his ceiling is the team improving in the short term. Like, next season, are they really Champions League contenders?
Quite possibly, if they sign the right players.
It's a big if.
It is a big if, and, like, things are slightly different for clubs like Everton. They don't need to sell somebody like Richarlison now because they have so much money. If they want to keep him, they can keep him. Without question, I would say by the time Mikel Arteta finishes, Arsenal will have made an unbelievable improvement. I think in the short term, though, that actually Everton can do a little bit more. Maybe I've just been to the Emirates too often and just been burnt by watching these Arsenal players. They frustrate the bloody life out of you. Like, there was one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen yesterday towards the end, where Mustafi makes this brilliant clearance, thinks the ball is going out of play for a throw-in, turns around, high fives Bernd Leno, but the ball hasn't gone out. Richarlison has kept it in, and he's totally out of position. It was just insane.
At least it's encouraging that Mikel Arteta absolutely hates that and is going crazy.
Yeah. You were obviously in England, as was the great Mayo benefactor. You shared a city with him yesterday while he was tweeting, whoring out. What did you make of this?
I don't think it's helpful for anybody. puts the players in a difficult position. Obviously, there's a close relationship between Tim O'Leary and a lot of the players, and James Horan's looking at this. It just adds another layer to the consistent shit show that's around Mayo football. Like, James Horan's, he's in a period of transition that we don't know if it's ever going to end, because like, he's throwing in 10, 12 young players, hoping that he'll get four or five of them. But they might not be ready till next year, and then the older players, are they going to be drifting out slowly? And you look at what Galway are doing. Like, there's no great buzz around Mayo. They're in Division 1 since, what, 1997? Like, it's a ridiculous record they've had. Like, this would be... Winning it last year was a big achievement. Staying in Division 1, it feels right now, would be a massive achievement. But look, James, there's no way in hell James Horan is going. And shouldn't. Like,
it's not
James
even a conversation.
Horan should pick the time that he goes, whenever it is. No matter what happens over the next couple of years, he's given enough and he's done enough to choose his own time. But, like, all right, things are bad. They haven't played well in any of the games, really, in the league. Like, you look at how
truth
Dublin,
hurts, Nathan. Truth hurts.
You look at how Dublin have struggled for some of their games, yet absolutely battered Mayo.
Yeah. I think between Tim O'Leary and Adrian Barry, you won't realise that tweeting at a rugby match is just a bad idea.
9:31 this morning. Thanks very much for popping in, Nathan. We're going to be back talking Bellator after this. OTB AM. Big night for Owen on Saturday night. He got to hang out in the Three Arena with all the Bellator fans and the purveyors of quality MMA action.
Absolutely. Rubbing shoulders with Bellator fans, Bellator fighters. What did I say earlier on? 14, 15 Irish fighters, 8 winners is what I had down. Spoke to a couple of them afterwards. Also spoke to a lot of the fight fans. Let's have a look at this.
Unbelievable, hey. Great night, hey.
I loved it. It's the second time at Bellator. Dublin's great city. Great night out. Great event here. Atmosphere is incredible.
Kiefer was unbelievable.
18 fights on the card tonight and I blew the fucking roof off the place more than anybody, yeah? It speaks for itself. The biggest draw here, so. I love my people, yeah? I fucking love my people. I carry these flags on purpose. Dublin, Ireland. I'm just a man of the people.
Crosby. Crosby is a Dublin lad, born and raised. Absolutely fucking warrior of a chap. Goes in there, puts on a show. Takes it no bother. He's just a warrior of fire. Absolute fucking deadly warrior.
Has this been the most incredible week of your life?
It's the best week of my life, yeah. On Tuesday, my son was born. I swear to God, best day of my life, yeah. My son and my daughter are everything to me. My family is everything to me. And then 2 big wins in 1 week. Another win tonight, my hand raised. More money in the bank. I get to go home to my son tonight, spend some time with him. And then really, I feel like I haven't even fucking seen him or met him yet.
Crosby is the man. He understands what we've all been through. He understands what we've all been through. So he's going to say, all right, I'm going to come out there and I'm going to scrap for all the boys. And he scraps for all of us. And that's it at the end of the day.
Mate, literally, yeah, a year ago, I was on €144 a week on the social welfare. Literally, a year ago. And then I saw my Bellator and my life change. Here I am now making serious bread, feeding my family, looking after everybody the way I fucking wanted to do this my whole life.
Goes in there, gives it all he can, man. Even if he's losing, makes a fucking comeback. Gets that Roy Cross in, gets close to the ground, all the wrestling. He's a fighter that every fighter wants to be. That's why I love Crosby.
I'm the big name. They fight me, they're fighting a big name. Everyone keeps saying, oh, do you want a big name? I'm a fucking big name. They fight me, they're fighting the big name. Listen to this crowd, mate. Listen to what I can do. Nobody does this shit. Nobody. I've been all over the place with this sport. Nobody blows the roof off the place like this. I'm the big fucking name here. That bloke should thank me to fight me. Do you know what I'm saying? So, whatever. They're here to see me.
My daughter does K1 as well. And I picture her up on the main event, myself, of course.
I just came to support Leah, first woman headlining a Bellator. So
I think there's going to be a video released of my weight cut this week, which is going. It was a tough, tough 36 hours. My body just stopped losing water. I was doing like 20 minutes in a bath, 40 minutes in a wrap, and losing 0.3. It was just horrendous. Actually, whenever I came down, we were cutting weight for like 36 hours. We came down to weigh in. It says I was 0.2 under my scales. And we got on the scales downstairs and it was 0.8 over after everybody checking the scales. And then I had hair extensions in and I went, cut my hair. So we ran into the bathroom, everybody started cutting my hair out.
Fighter of the night, Beck, Liam McCourt.
Beck Rawlings, I'm backing her all
the
way.
Liam McCourt, yeah. Mate, I thought her arm was broken. She carried on. Yeah, she didn't give up. That was unreal. Unreal performance.
There was like 18 minutes to go. They're like, hey, Leah, 18 minutes. Everybody was running, cutting my hair extensions out. Then I was like, right, well, we'll keep cutting my hair because like, or we'll get in the treadmill. So Aaron Chalmers ran up and grabbed the sweatshirt and he was like, right, put that on. So I was running on the treadmill for like 6 minutes or like 3 minutes left, Leah. So I ran back into the toilet. Everybody kept cutting my hair and I ran in like, and my bra was like, just made it like within 5 minutes to go with the weigh-in time. It was crazy.
I thought it was really good. I think seeing a female Irish fighter fight in the main event in Dublin is fantastic. I think it's brilliant for the women's game. I think we've really taken a step forward in terms of Irish MMA.
You feel unbelievably privileged to be Irish in these situations, man, because any other fucking nationality in the world wouldn't get this support.
Did you go down in the Lewis past the GPO again today?
No, I didn't, unfortunately. I'm living out in Ballantyre instead of Fribsborough now. But I went in and like I had a little walk around the customs house and I was like, this is where they attacked, you know, this is the bus. So I did get that little bit of a chill kind of coming up to it, and I had the headphones on, I had all the rebel tunes going again, so.
Yeah, you know, you can't explain it until you're in the seat, sitting there in front of the ring or the cage, whatever way you want to describe it. It's a good atmosphere, it's great energy.
Look, like, you're unbelievably privileged to be Irish is the way I feel with all of these situations. And like, you know, I know I was early enough in the card, but still, the buzz, the reaction, the everything, like, it stirs something deep in your soul. And like, we're an island nation. I think we do have a bigger kind of cultural affinity to each other than anyone else. Like, we get behind our own, and that's a fucking beautiful thing. And like, you know, and no matter, like, I suppose fighting is a little bit more intense, but no matter what sport we have, we get in behind it. And like, I feel it's super privileged to be an Irish combat athlete on nights like tonight.
You can feel it. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody wants to be here. It's good energy, you know? So it's good for Dublin.
Insane. I just kept telling myself, there's no way I'm losing in front of this crowd. There's no way I'm going to let these motherfuckers down. So I had to go out there and bite down on my mouth guard and swing. And my coach, he saw me getting into a slugfest. He's like, all right, get it out of your system. Because I just needed to swing for the fences and get it out. So, and I did, so it feels good.
To be honest, I think the main thing about tonight is that we're all here backing the Irish. The Irish, we always win it. We have the good fans behind us. We've got the good support behind us.
I was riding horses for 20 years, which is a bit mad. And I did every sort of equestrian sport there was and worked in the Curragh, and I rode in a couple of races, and I worked for Desi Hughes, you know, one of the biggest national hunt trainers in the country. And one morning I just woke up and says, I've had enough of this. I'm going to sell everything. So I sold all my horses and left my gear in the yard I was working in. And I said, that's it now, I'm done. I've done 20 years and I don't feel like I can go any further in this sport. And about 3 or 4 months later, I found myself in an MMA gym.
Would any of your Irish opponents formerly have made a good MMA fighter?
Sean O'Brien fancies himself as a bit of a scrapper. He keeps wanting to fight me, but and he's got massive farmer strength, and he's got big sausage fingers. So I think he could be quite challenging. But I just punch him in the hip, and then that'd be the end of it.
We just want to keep going winning with the Irish, you know how they like, all the way, keep across this camp, all the way, SVG. Come on, the boys, you know what I mean? That's it, boy, that's it, mate.
I'd actually give props to the jockeys more than the fighters, because some of the best lads are riding 5 days a week. And say Galway Race Week, they ride 7 days of the week. So they cut weight every single morning and they ride emaciated and depleted. And they go out and they ride half a ton of an animal around a track, jumping fences, completely depleted. So this is definitely tough, but we have a long window to recover. What the jockeys do is unreal.
I sold 280 tickets here. You know, if I heard it out there, I have the whole lot of drama behind me, I have the whole town sponsoring me, I've the best support in the world, you know, the whole, like, we're the biggest town in Ireland, but everybody knows each other, so everyone gets behind each other. And I actually like to say that the state that Drogheda is in at the moment, I'm fighting for those, you know, I want to say, right, there's a good thing to come out of Drogheda, and I was able to say no to what's going on, because I grew up all these people, what's going on in Drogheda, and I was confident to say no between doing my sport and stuff, so I'd like to say, yeah, I'm fighting for those people as well, you know.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Kieran Clark finishing that. Pretty interesting night.
Absolutely.
Apologies for the language. Retrospectively, we meant to give you a warning.
Yeah, apologies.
You're in the car listening on...
If microphone picked up any unsavoury language. it was good night. A couple of other things from it, as I said at the start. It was actually tamer than I thought. I was expecting this to be an absolutely off the charts sort of event. Apparently the one in September was. People who are there who know a lot more about Bellator and have been to a lot more events than me told me that last September was crazy. This one was a little bit more toned down. Disappointing that people did leave before the main event, Liam McCourt, but still fantastic to see her get the headline bout after James Gallagher pulled out. He will now be fighting on May 16th, I think it is, in London. That's the same card that James Haskell is on. And again, as I said earlier on, Bellator at the moment really feels like the SBG show. John Kavanagh basically in the corner for all the fighters, it seems. So I think they're coming back in August, shortly after the UFC. So how close it is to that card in Dublin remains to be seen. I think the sweet spot is probably a month. Get people to go to the UFC and then they want a bit more MMA and then they'll buy a ticket to Bellator. But yeah, pretty good night.
Are you now hooked? You're going to go to all of them?
I would definitely go again. I just think the main card was disappointing at the weekend, and I think most people who were there would probably admit that they probably needed a better show of excitement from their main fights. People didn't even hang around to watch the main event, you know, yeah. which is disappointing, but still worth going to.
All right, some comments for you on the rugby. Killian Fitzgerald has used the hashtag OTBAM to get in touch with us. Bar Wales last week, Sexton has been poor against top-level international teams since November 18, yet his place never gets questioned. None of the top international sides would show such loyalty. Loads of YouTube comments as well. Danny B says, people calling for Sexton to be dropped, neither heads examined. He's won poor game, otherwise brilliant for Leinster and Ireland since the World Cup. Murray struggles, says Alan O'Neill, slow getting the pass away at the ruck, and the box kicks just gave him the ball back 20 yards away when we really needed to put some possession phases together. Dara O'Toole says, so we beat the reigning champions by 24-12 and it's because Wales were terrible. We lose to England World Cup finalists in Twickenham by the same margin and we're worse than we've ever been. We didn't beat Wales 24-12. We scored four tries. Was it 24-12? Was it the score? I can't even remember. But 24-14. And I think that Dara is giving us a bit more credit there than a lot of people. I think we can be delusional and go, oh, if it wasn't for the two touchdowns and the missed kicks, we would have won the game. I mean, you can make that case if you want, but I'm not going to entertain it. They definitely were a smash. Did you see the scrums, the amount of turnovers? Says not public. Alan O'Neill says Sexton had a couple of bad moments but did a great job defensively, with Manu coming down his channel non-stop, was getting slow ball all day from Murray, tough to get the backs into space with it. Why is nobody mentioning the first two tries were absolute gifts? I mean, we did mention that, but like we gifted them with our shitty play. We didn't, like, it wasn't a fluke. It was like Stockdale had not played well up to that point either. There was a bad kick from Murray which didn't go very deep, which Stockdale didn't chase well enough, which one of the England players caught by the touchline. And instead of getting smashed into touch, Stockdale kind of tackled him infield instead of putting him out, which would have been our lineup. And they scored the try off that. Anybody who could watch that match and get any positives out of it is delusional. This isn't the small pond of private schools in Ireland. This is international rugby and they're not up to it, says Not Public. This is an interesting point. The size of our playing pool is tiny and it is becoming smaller and smaller as the private schools pick up kids from 12 who come and board, or the ones who are brought in to do their Leaving Cert.
The whole idea of Ireland being not up to scratch when it comes to international rugby, it's something that was voiced at the World Cup, it's clearly being voiced by that texter now. Is that true when we look at what Leinster are doing? Or is it because all our talent is concentrated in such a province that of course Leinster are going to look good on the club scene?
This is a good question, Owen. Give me an answer.
Well, it's certainly something that you look at and you're like, we can't just accept we're not good enough. If they're going toe-to-toe with, say, Saracens in the Champions Cup final last year, granted, Saracens were better. I'll accept that. But Leinster, top two team in Europe, unquestionably now the best team in Europe. How is Ireland managing to produce the best club team in European rugby and we can also have this argument being floated out there that we don't have the players? Nonsense. We do have the players. They play for the best club team in Europe. Now, like, it's not a stone-cold thing that we are the best team in Europe all automatically in Test rugby because we've got concentrated into one province. But we're not as bad as we've shown against England in their last three appearances. They spanked us. They're not that much better than us. Well, they are better than us.
Yeah, they've got our number, though.
They certainly do.
So that's the issue. It's that they have our number, and so South Africa can watch that and have our number, and France can watch that and have our number. Like, there's now a template to beat Ireland. It's like, beat the crap out of us, smothering defence, be a little bit offside and bore in the scrum and do it that way. Kieran Fortune, two more for you. All the oldies need to go. A few others are not made for big teams like England. Herring needs to be changed. Toner does nothing except jump. Sexton and Murray need to go to the bench. Stockdale can't jump. White Men Can't Jump, Kieran Fortune channeling his inner 90s basketball movies. And Michael White says, it's Italy, we should make 5-7. We will make 5-7 changes for the Italy game. It's the France game that we're ultimately talking about the selection for. Do Cooney, Doris, Kelleher, Addison, if they play in the Italy game, do they get to keep their position for the France game? And what's more likely, that the team that played in Twickenham is somehow going to find form between now and the game in Paris, or that a new team might actually be able to take this on to the next level and go, I'm gonna go after their 20-year-old out half who looks amazing. France were astonishingly good, I thought, in an away match against a Welsh team. I thought that they're back, and it's great for rugby that they're back, but it's a new dark age for Ireland. That's my takeaway from the weekend.
I think you're being too negative. I think that it's very hard to take any positives away from yesterday. I'll accept that. But that we're entering into a new dark age, I just don't buy.
Bang in the 80s off this, Owen. France good, England good. England just good in a way that we can never be good because they're bigger than us and stronger than us. How do you beat that?
You watched the under-20s on Friday night? Does that not give you a little bit...
I didn't watch the under-20s.
Like, Islam is on, playing good rugby. A couple of big talents in the pack coming through. Like, it's encouraging. But whether or not this is the antithesis to a dark age of rugby, I don't know. Underage teams are always a risky thing to hang your hat on.
Yeah.
So I
don't know. If they win a Grand Slam, it might actually be better if they didn't win a Grand Slam, because they'll all be like, oh, golden generation, next generation coming through. It's like, let them have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. It's only the under-20s. We need to stop. In Ireland, if you've won the minors, geez, you're great.
Wasn't Anthony Moyles in here just complaining about me the under-20s? We've got to have some consistency here on OTB.
I mean, I think that you can have a little bit of both. It's good. Maybe the defeat will be the making of them as seniors in years to come. Right, plenty for you to get your teeth stuck into on the podcast of the show this morning. If you missed any of it, we had Andy Lee talking about Tyson Fury. We had a deep dive on Colin McShane's injury, Patrick Reed's WGC Mexico win, Rory finished fifth. Much more for you across the day on offtheball.com as well. Monday Night Rugby, the football show, and much more besides coming on the radio tonight with Off The Ball. You can listen 24/7 to OTB Sports Radio. Just get us on the Go Loud app or tell your smart speaker to play OTB Sports Radio on TuneIn. We'll be back tomorrow at 7:30. Best of luck.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an Off The Ball Podcast Network presentation.